And Simon's contagious in moments like these.
Consume me and strengthen my will to appease
the passion that sparked me one terrible night.
It shocked and persuaded my soul to ignite.
Hi, everybody. We're live.
Hey, so let me just go on an apology tour right now, because we were supposed to record yesterday at the normal time, and Tuesday I woke up and I felt like a truck had ran me over. Wednesday, the truck backed over me, and I was like, fellas, I cannot do this today. And so my many thanks to my beloved co-hosts for being flexible. We are recording this on Thursday, and we are doing it during the day, which generally speaking, we don't like to do because oftentimes there's like leaf blowers or in the summertime there's weed whackers or whatever and all sorts of background noise.
Barking so dogs, don't forget, you're going to hear them soon.
Yep, the barking dogs. You'll probably hear Penny pawing at the office door trying to get in. So all this to say, if the audio sounds like garbage, Casey's fault, not Marco's fault, Casey's fault. So that's my bad. We didn't want to record this time, but I begged my beloved co-hosts to do it earlier in the day to ensure that I stayed awake for all of it, which they were gracious and kind enough to do. So if the audio is not exactly up to snuff, again, my fault, not Marco's.
I mean, it'll probably be fine because first of all, Isotope exists and it's awesome. But also, you know, in typical Casey fashion, you are throwing yourself so far under the bus before there's even a problem, and there probably won't even be a problem. So
yeah, we change the day of the show all the time. It's not a big deal. We're one day off. It's fine.
Well, yeah, I'm not as much worried about the move of the day, but the move of the time, because I know there's probably going to be leaf blowers.
Well, we might have take a dog barking break and maybe multiple dog barking breaks, and there is a leaf blower going in the distance, but you probably can't hear it. So, yeah.
Oh, I can hear it. But it's fine. Isotope is wonderful for filtering those things out. But I mean, the biggest challenge I had with this schedule was trying to figure out, what do I drink during this episode? Water's boring. And water's always my backup. I always have like a cup of water as a backup, but I want something more fun. Like forever ago, like in our first year, I used to drink beer during the show, but that, you know, for many reasons we decided that was probably not amazingly professional.
I remember we deciding that. Maybe you decided that.
I agree with you,
by the way.
Yeah. Oh, and I also stopped. I always had a pre-flight to drink, if you will. And after I went way too far during that one infamous Mac Pro discussion. Never again, and it has not happened since. I don't believe I've had a single drop of alcohol on a recording day since that time.
I have not drunk any alcohol before, after, or during the recording of any podcast ever.
Or around, or near, or in the proximity of, or...
Yes, that's true.
2 days before or after.
or within several decades of.
Yeah, right, exactly. So normally I would just have, like, you know, I mentioned I like the non-alcoholic Guinness, the Guinness Zero, which is surprisingly indistinguishable from, like, regular alcoholic Guinness. But it feels too early in the day even for a non-alcoholic beer. So I went with coffee and a hop water, which I guess...
I was expecting hop water. That was my guess.
Yeah, even the hop water, like, I went with, like... the lime flavor, I figure that's more daytime. Like, you know, it's hard to choose for, like, you know, 3:30 in the afternoon. But for an activity, I don't know. I decided
it'll be dark in like a half an hour or so. You can have
beer. I know.
Well, I appreciate your flexibility, gentlemen. And for the listeners, your flexibility as well. All right, let's do some follow-up. And a little birdie has told me, because John did not tell me, that John has received some new presents.
Oh, yeah, in my continuing saga of Vision Pro stuff arriving at my house, couple things. I did get my lens inserts. Did I talk about that on last episode?
You mentioned you were going to get the lens inserts. Right. I don't think we know that you did.
Yeah. Anyway, right. I did get them. They work well. I'm actually kind of surprised that the balance between me trying it with my mismatched contacts versus my correct lens inserts, because the mismatched contacts are not quite right. One of my eyes has slightly the wrong prescription, but they have the advantage of not having a second pair of lenses in there, and the second pair of lenses does add more internal reflections and also external reflections for light leaking through, which is another issue we'll get to in a second. So it actually is interesting. Like, I really have no choice. I can't do the contact thing because I would have to put the contacts in, put the Vision Pro on, take them off when I take it out because I can't, because my vision is bad. And my contacts that are calibrated for our distance, I can't look at the computer or my phone, and that's not good. I have to get reading glasses. Anyway, so the inserts are way better. Now I can just put the thing on anytime I want. It makes all that much better. But the internal reflections, which is one of the things that bothered me even before I got the inserts, they are actually a little bit worse. And when I mean by internal reflections, I mean light from the screens somehow bouncing around inside the lenses and causing little, like, glowy things inside the lenses. That's what I mean. Maybe I'm using the wrong term for that. But what I mean by quote-unquote external reflections is when light gets into the Vision Pro from the room and bounces off the lenses and does things. And you can tell when it's an external one because if you block that gap between the light shield and your face, the thing goes away. When it's a reflection coming from the screens, even if you're in a pitch black room, you still see them. There's no way to stop those. But the external ones, like if only the face shield fit correctly around your face and didn't have any gaps, then no light could get in there. And the face shield I got, like the process for determining this is when you go buy it in an Apple store, they make you scan your face with your phone and turn your head and do all this stuff. Like they're trying to get a scan of your face and they say, we think you should get this light shield. And they come with like this number letter combination that's kind of obscure. By the way, I've learned that kind of obscure number letter combination is kind of obscure for a reason, because Apple didn't want to give people a complex about like, you got a fat face, right? Like they didn't want to make it like, they didn't even want to do like small, medium, large or like inch measurements or whatever. So the only part that is distinguishable is the last letter, which is like W or N for wide or narrow. That's okay. But the other numbers are just like a lookup table as far as I can tell. Like we have a bunch of different variations and lots of things vary on them. And even though it's represented by one number, that one number is just a lookup, an index on a lookup table, as far as I can tell. So that was interesting. And on that front, I mentioned that I had like gaps by my temples for the face shield that I have. When I did it with the app, it said, I forget what it said. Like, Casey, you were having me do it. You didn't actually tell me why. You're like, do me a favor, go to the, in typical Casey fashion, go to the Apple Store app and make like you're going to get a Vision Pro and put it into your cart and see what it says and whatever. And I did that, and then you asked me, like, did you say you have contacts or whatever? Because it asked you those questions. I'm like, no, I lied. I didn't think it mattered. I was just doing what you told me to do. So I went back and did it a second time and told the truth and said, yes, I have glasses and this and that and the other thing. And then sent you the screenshot, and then you told me, you know, the whole deal about it. You were going to send me your Vision Pro and all that stuff. Anyway, I think I got two different answers from those two scans in terms of, like, what size should your light shield be? I don't remember what they were, but I'm pretty sure they were different. And I thought maybe they're different because the second time I said I was going to have lens inserts and it wants to accommodate for them or something like that. Who knows? Fast forward to now me using your Vision Pro with my own face shield that was 25W, I think, and that had gaps around the temples. And so I had a press briefing from Apple for my Vision, for my old Vision Pro, and one of the things I discussed with them was the fit and the gap and asking them like what their experience is with fit and the sizing and all this other stuff. They suggested that I do the fit thing again, and I did it like four times, and three of those four times I got like 23W, and one of the four times I got 25W. My face was the same the whole time, I swear to you. Like, but you know, it's just variability. So it seems like majority rules it should be 23W. So now I have a 23W face shield. Oh, the other thing I complained about, by the way, was that a Vision Pro would complain, we're trying to do the optic ID thing, but your eyes are too far from the screen. And if I pressed the thing against my face more, it would make up for it. And I was using the thinner pad to get it closer. So I got a 23W. And visually, what I can tell is the 23W is not as deep as the 25W. So it does, in fact, put the things closer to my eyeballs. And that seemed to help. I no longer get the optic ID thing that says, your eyes are too far from the screen. But the gaps around the temples are still there because it's still a W. It's not like the narrow one, and maybe the narrow one would be too narrow, and maybe the wide one would be too wide, but all this is to say that the advice I got from Apple, and that I agree with them would probably do if I was buying one of these, is you can buy one of these in an Apple store, and if you go into an Apple store and you're going to buy one, you can ask to like try on the different size face shields. Yes, of course, the Apple give you a suggested thing or whatever, but you can also say, can I actually try a 23W with like your Vision Pro as, you know, the display one or whatever? Because you're about to spend $3,500, probably they'll, you know, they'll let you try different sizes on. And that's what you should do. And if I was going to actually buy my very own Vision Pro, I would do that. I think 23W is better than 25W, but I think it's still not quite right. So sizing is tricky. As to the briefing, nothing too exciting in that. The one thing I did note was, I'm sure they do this in all the Vision Pro demos. I've never had one before, but like, they show you a 3D model of the Vision Pro itself. Did you, either one of you, do this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just a 3D model of the Vision Pro, and you can look at it or whatever, but it made me appreciate something I also appreciate when I look at the widgets, like hanging pictures, virtual pictures on my walls and stuff like that. Kind of like in special effects in movies, there are things you can do to make things convincing that pay huge dividends for a small effort. And one of those is correct lighting for 3D objects. Like, a lot of the magic of the Vision Pro, like, that looks like it's really in my room. It's not because the rendering is, like, amazing with ray tracing and, like, amazing textures and stuff like that. It's because they get the lighting right. And they get the lighting right because they know everything that's going on around you with all those cameras everywhere. And the model of the Vision Pro, yes, it's a high-resolution model with lots of polygons and high-resolution textures, and you can zoom it to make it real big, and you can get to the limits of the textures or whatever, but the reason it looks so convincing is because they light it with, even if it's just simple as, like, white balancing to the same white balance in the room, that goes so far. Like, anytime you've ever seen, like, bad, quote-unquote, bad special effects in movies, especially if you're my age and have seen bad special effects in the age before computers, merely getting the white balance slightly wrong will make two things look like they're not in the same place. That's it. And getting it right makes even the lowest polygon, lowest resolution textured thing look like it's really there in the room. Because apparently in our perception, getting the white balance and obviously the perspective and stuff right, and having it be stable and not jump around, which all of which the Vision Pro does, makes it very convincing. So surprisingly, looking at the model of the Vision Pro, which is just, you know, it's just a 3D model of the thing you've already got in your face that you can see in real life, was fascinating and interesting. Of course, the 3D model also had the dual knit band on it, so they have updated the model a little bit. But anyway, that's about it. It was nice, and I continue to enjoy it. I did watch the Flight Ready short today, and I thought it was fun. Although, because I watch all the sailing channels on YouTube, I almost kind of wish they concentrated more on the aircraft carrier than the airplanes. But, you know, the planes get all the glory.
They sure do. We got an incredible piece of feedback sometime over the last week. And I couldn't be happier about it, at least as I sit here now. And I've gotten word that maybe I will change my mind in a minute, but that's okay. We got this feedback from Jonathan Goforth, who writes, "Forgive me for being late to this particular feedback, but I only recently became a member and started listening through the back catalog of member specials. As I recall, one of Syracuse's primary complaints about CDRs that kept them out of the S tier was their reliability and their degradation over time. This made me realize that I am actually in a position to test this pretty well. For the past 18 years, I've been photographing community theater productions. Each show would result in hundreds of photos, so in the early years, the best way to distribute those photos to people was to burn them to CDR and hand them out directly to people. I also keep all the exported files in various hard drive-based storage solutions that have been moved around over the years. I pulled hundreds of images off a cheap, ordinary CDR that I burned 16 years ago, and I did a bit compare to files that I've kept on spinning hard drives for the same time, and they are absolutely exactly the same. As a passive storage medium, there's nothing more we can ask of it. The existence of a cheap, easy-to-produce product is what allowed me to run the business that I did for years before the internet made it more reasonable for everyone to just download the files. CDR deserves nothing less than S tier. Boom! Roast it.
So I know you're a sickie, Casey, but I'm going to ask you to maybe try doing the work for me. What am I going to say about this feedback?
That the bit rot was the same on the spinning hard drives or something like
no,
that?
No. No. Good. Try again.
Probably that it's just one data point or...
That 16 years
is there. Is there a common phrase in the parlance that expresses that idea succinctly?
I believe it's anecdata? That you are wrong about CDRs and their ST.
Casey was closer with anecdata. The plural of anecdote is not data. We've had people write in before to say, I know you think CDRs are unreliable, but I got a bunch of CDRs and they're all fine, therefore you're wrong. Cool story, bro. I mean, I have a bunch of CDs that are bad. Right? If only there were some way to determine the reliability of CDRs rather than just our individual stories. And sometimes individual stories are compelling, and of course we believe our own experiences are much more important than anyone else's experience, because certainly in my experience, I have so many completely unreadable CDRs that yes, that does color my view, because it is my personal experience. But it's not unfounded. My opinion of the reliability of CDRs, and by the way, there are other factors that kept them out of S tier, as this feedback notes, so thank you, Jonathan, is not just based on my personal experiences. It's founded in the science of how they are made. And we've discussed ad nauseum all of those factors that go into them being unreliable. So I'm glad Jonathan has some CDRs that he can still read. I've got a bunch that I can't read. None of that changes the overall reliability of CDRs, which is not great.
I think the problem is that Jonathan was clearly using a PC and you were using Macs, and the Macs were just not as good at it.
I don't know if that's... I mean, my CDR was like so freaking expensive. It was SCSI. It was a SCSI CDR.
Maybe that was your problem.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
No,
maybe it wasn't terminated right and the laser was weak.
Yeah, the termination was a black art, but I did eventually get it right, and that wouldn't cause write problems. But yeah, no, I'm sad about my broken CDRs. That's the last time I checked, was so many years ago. I should check again. They probably, the rest of them are probably all gone bad. It's grim.
I mean, were you keeping them in like a humidor? Like what was the storage situation?
No, like here? I mean, I was thinking about this the other day. Like, am I the type of person who abuses the things that I own, especially the computer stuff? Like, these things were handled like they were like in a clean room and like a silicon fab.
Hold on, are they in the attic? Because the attic is not HVAC controlled, is it?
The attic is somewhat temperature controlled.
Wait, are they in the attic?
Most of them are in the basement in sleeves, filed away. And the basement,
so they're in the extraordinarily moist basement.
It's not moist. It's not my basement. How dare you? How dare you? My basement is well dehumidified with humidity detection in that. Forget it. No. Yeah, basement is. Yeah, it is. My basement is beautiful. My basement is better dehumidified than the rest of the house because the giant dehumidifier we have is only in the basement. And sometimes I say, you know, we should get a dehumidifier for the upstairs. But anyway, my basement is not humid. And they're inside beautiful Case Logic cases. And I like, towards the end of when I was making CDRs, when I had already had some go bad, like over the lifetime of the existence of CDRs, and I was getting super paranoid about it. I mean, I was already buying like the best ones I could get, make sure there's the name brand, whatever the thing is about, you know, the best ones you could get. No, of course, never writing on them, because you would never write on a CDR because the back surface is where the stuff is, and any kind of damage to that back surface is actually worse than damage to the front surface, right? No stickers. Can't do that because that could damage them as well.
Oh, God. I put stickers on all my
CDRs. That was not recommended if you want them to last.
They'd spin off balance and they would shatter at 52X.
Yeah. So what I was doing was writing only on the clear part in the middle. Right?
Oh, wow.
So I was
very John.
That's how much care I was taking of these things. And still so many of them are dead last time I checked, which must be like 5 years from now. So, yeah, I don't have great luck. I'm glad Jonathan does.
That's just because you were using a Mac. Us PC folks, we knew what was up. We had the good CDRs.
Yeah. Get the Tyo Udins. Later the Ritex.
All right. Tell me about.
Got too expensive.
Yeah. Tell me about touchscreen MacBook Pros.
This didn't come up when we were talking about the M6 MacBook Pros, the German rumors that they're going to have touchscreens. That's very exciting. We talked about it on an earlier episode, but never once did we mention how great this is going to be for iPad apps on your Mac. You can already run iPad apps on your Mac, but sometimes it's a little bit weird when you're using a mouse cursor with an iPad Mac. Guess what? If it's got a touchscreen, iPad apps become much more natural. Now, I'm not saying you're going to be able to draw on the screen with the Apple Pencil and make your laptop tip over or whatever. What I am saying is that whether or not macOS is updated and to what degree it might be updated to accommodate touch, iPad apps are already made for touch, and it's going to be great to see them on the Mac with a touchscreen.
I think all of the weird ergonomics of touching your Mac screen precisely and frequently, I think will make that no good.
But I mean, you don't have to. You still can use them the way you're using them now, but there are certain interfaces and iPad apps that are just more natural with touch, like Pinch to Zoom or something like that. And I think this will lend it so well. I'm not saying suddenly you're not going to use the mouse cursor with your iPad apps on your Mac. I'm saying that there are instances where it would be more natural to use touch, and now you can.
Yeah, fair.
All right. I lamented last episode that the Synology Drive icon that I put in my sidebar was full color and did not fit well with the rest of my sidebar, and I was casting about for a solution. And Charlie Elman writes, symbolic links might help you solve the Finder sidebar problem. I hate how Microsoft OneDrive is shown as OneDrive, long company name. So I made a symbolic link to the OneDrive cloud storage folder and called it whatever I wanted. Then I dragged that sim link into the Finder sidebar. The sidebar item opens OneDrive like normal when clicked, keeps my new name, and only shows a boring folder icon, not the OneDrive icon. Did this, worked perfectly. Thank you, Charlie.
Ta-da! Unix to the rescue.
Indeed.
See, to auto-generated. Me, like, symlinks and stuff, I always am afraid, like, this is going to cause some weird bug. Because, like, it's so often, like, software is written in such a way where, like, it works if you follow the happy path and what you assume people will do. But, you know, if you do something a little bit off the beaten path, like use a symlink for its files, like I always worry like something is going to go wrong there.
Yeah, that fear is founded because there are ways that it can screw things up. But the beauty about this is that he's not actually, Casey's not changing Synology Drive. The Synology Drive software is still running on the same thing it used to run. This symlink is a thing totally off the side that Synology Drive has no idea even exists and doesn't need to know or care about. Its only function is to get him the correct icon on the sidebar and to open the thing when it's clicked in the Finder. Synology Drive doesn't have to know that thing exists at all. Doesn't know that thing exists at all. That's the beauty of the solution. If it ever breaks, what's going to happen is Casey's going to click on the sidebar. It's not going to work. Oh, well. But Synology Drive never knew that symlink existed.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk auto-generated chapters in Apple Podcasts. Matt Dickoff writes, in the last episode, you mentioned that Apple's new auto-generated chapter markers won't have much impact on ATP, but you do release a podcast without chapter markers. The bootleg. It'd be great to get those for the auto-generated chapters. For that feed, for those of us that listen to the bootleg before the edited feed is released.
So that's an interesting
idea. What
Matt
means by that is that when we release the bootleg, which is shortly after we finish recording, there's no chapters in the bootleg, obviously, because it's just a straight from a recording dumped out there. But also, the bootleg will eventually share the show notes with the edited episode. But if the edited episode has not been edited and has not been published, there are no show notes. So there is this gap of time where you have the bootleg, you can listen to it, but there's no notes whatsoever because you're listening before Marco has even gotten to the edited episode. So Apple's auto-generated chapters, good luck with the bootleg, but yeah, they can auto-generate chapters for you, presuming it's able to do so on a private feed, which I'm not sure how that works.
Yeah, so far, when Apple has done things like transcription, which I assume the auto-generated chapter feature is being done in the same process and is most likely using the transcript as input to, like, I'm sure it's probably feeding the transcript to an LLM and saying, you know, summarize this and tell me where the breaks are, basically.
That's what Merlin has been doing manually for Rectifs for a long time.
Yeah, which is great. That's a great idea. And in fact, I'm frustrated because they beat me to it because that's totally my idea and I've had it and I've been working on it for months. Anyway.
Maybe you should be a multi-billion dollar corporation. Ever think of that, Marco?
Anyway, someday I might ship a feature like this. In the meantime, so what Apple Podcasts has done to date with their transcript feature is it only applies to public feeds. So this most likely would not apply to your private member bootleg feed. It would probably only apply to Apple's public feeds. And this can make some sense when you think about, like, first of all, just data access wise, Apple Podcasts does server-side crawling sort of most of the time, but doesn't do, like, they don't proxy the downloads. I mean, neither does anybody who works on the RSS feed. But basically, Apple Podcasts has never wanted to involve themselves in the dealings of private feeds. They just kind of pass it through to the app and don't touch it server-side or anything like that. And so also, if you would do private feed transcription and stuff, you would have so many more because you think about it, you know, ATP has one public feed. We have many members and each one of those members has their own feed. So there could be orders of magnitude more feeds with different episodes to transcribe.
Especially for like popular shows with like millions of listeners and,
right.
You know.
Yeah,
huge
think about like the New York Times just moved all of their podcasts, including like The Daily, Ezra Klein, like, you know, big shows. These are like some of the top shows in Overcast. And the New York Times just moved all of them to the model where like you get the first few episodes for free, but otherwise you got to be a subscriber and they have private feeds. So think about like the number of feeds and, you know, Slate Plus has been doing this forever. Patreon, any podcast that's on Patreon, they have per person feeds. I can tell you from running Overcast database, this is a huge number of feeds. And so Apple so far has not transcribed those for lots of reasons. Mainly, I would assume, just the sheer numbers of them. It could be like 10 times as many feeds as what they're doing for the public. And you figure like their value of like the processing power they would spend server side to transcribe something for one person is a lot less valuable to them. In, you know, in an environment where you don't have infinite resources, although Apple kind of does, but anyway, it's a lot more valuable to them to transcribe public feeds because many more people will benefit from that. So I wouldn't expect this feature to work on private feeds in Apple Podcasts, at least for a while. Maybe down the road they'll start doing it for all podcasts. or they can start doing it device side. But even then, like doing it device side, that's, again, you might think, great, do it locally on the phone with the local LLM, local transcription API. You can do that, but it's not fast. And you can't really do a lot of it in the background either, because background time limitations and background processing limitations. And so it's not the kind of thing that can be gracefully done locally on device on iOS with the current limitations. So maybe down the road this might be a thing. Currently, I wouldn't expect it to be. But we'll see. This feature is still very much in beta, hasn't launched yet, so we'll see how it goes.
And yes, Apple could, if they wanted, allow you to submit a private feed and then have it index it. And like, it should, like, ideally, it would recognize that the audio file is the same, because we don't do dynamic ad insertion, so the audio files literally would be the same for all our members, and only transcribe it once and share the transcription and yada yada. These are all things that could happen, mm-hmm. but I'm guessing that they are not currently happening with the system as it exists.
Yeah, but I bet down the road, I bet they eventually get there, because transcripts for podcasts are a major feature. They have huge accessibility value. Plus, once people get accustomed to navigating within a podcast app by the transcript or being able to just jump over to it, it's weird when, you know, if you subscribe to the paid version of something, it's weird that like, oh, I just can't do that with this show. Like, it's a negative experience. So once people get accustomed to transcripts being very popular, which is already happening thanks to Apple Podcasts, like, we're already on that path. I think there'll be a lot more of a push to get it working on all podcasts, and that will probably require, you know, local device processing, and we'll see how that goes.
Additionally, Stephen Robles writes, Apple will pull chapters from ID3 tags in JSON just like before, but also plain text timestamps in an episode description, kind of like YouTube. Creators can also opt out of auto-generated chapters completely. I'm curious how shows with dynamic ads will deal with chapters, if at all. Lastly, continues Stephen, subscriber audio chapters are a mess. I crash out about it here. We'll
there
put
you
a
go.
Link to, we'll put a link to their podcast.
What he's referring to is Apple's thing where you pay Apple using like iTunes,
right.
Whatever. You pay using your Apple account, just like you pay for in-app purchases. You can pay to get access to a private podcast, and of course Apple takes a cut. We don't use that system, to be clear, because Apple takes a cut. But that system does exist, and that's what he's referring to.
Right. And so on Primary Technology with Jason Eden, Stephen kind of summarized, says Apple has historically stripped the embedded chapter info from MP3s uploaded as subscriber-only audio files. Apple's still stripping them out of subscriber MP3 files, but there's now the option to add chapters to subscriber audio as plain text timestamps in the episode description. Sounds good, right? But the episode description is shared with the free version of the episode, and the timestamps are probably different in the ad-free subscriber version. Womp womp.
But boggles my mind, because like, I bet they're stripping it because they're like, oh, well, this is a subscriber one, and the chapters might not be the same, but that doesn't make any sense because they're embedded in the file. But like, right. There's a lot of wrongheaded stuff going on with chapters. Like, Stephen is trying to do the right thing. He's trying to provide the best possible product, and Apple is literally undoing his work when he uploads the member audio. Reason number a million why we roll around.
Yeah. Also, like, keep in mind, like, you know, the world of big podcasts that uses dynamic ad insertion and everything, which is at this point almost all big podcasts, they've never supported chapters because the DAI platforms don't support the insertion of chapters, because they would have to custom code that. Now, there's nothing stopping them from, like, the DAI servers that will say, like, all right, I have markers for this episode. We're allowed to insert ads here, here, and here. And I'm going to put in 30 seconds here, 60 seconds here, 90 seconds here. So that way, timestamps from this range of the episode, timestamps should be adjusted 30 seconds forward.
No one can do that. Math, Marco. It's too hard.
Right, exactly. It's super
There's
simple.
Addition and subtraction.
Right. But because it's so rare that any of those big podcasts have ever even considered the idea of chapters, because of that, there's been no pressure on the DAI, like, software serving side to support that very basic math. And there's no reason why they can't do it. They already are editing the file for each configuration of the download. They already have to modify the tags at the beginning of the file to properly account for the length, which they used to not do, and it caused a lot of problems. But they're doing it now. So they already have all the software in place to do this. They just don't care, because no one in the world of big podcasts has ever heard of chapters, and every time a German tech fan tells them, it just falls on the floor and they ignore it. So that you wouldn't believe how many times over the years people have proposed, quote, new standards, or have pitched me on ideas for some kind of new standard they're going to do, that puts markers in podcast files at certain times to do something, maybe show some kind of metadata at certain times in a file. So many people have had this idea over and over again over the years because they don't know about chapters. And no one knows about chapters. So it is kind of fun that Apple is finally, and granted Spotify did this first, and I think YouTube is even doing stuff like this now, but Apple finally is like, okay, look, no one's doing chapters. We're going to just do it client-side for you. Like, that's it. Because chapters are very useful for the audience, and they love them, and, you know, so we're just going to do it, and you're going to basically suck it up. Like, you didn't do it for all these years. We're going to do it for you. So overall, this is a great way to go, and I think it will dramatically improve the podcast listening experience. There are going to be some problems with ads, but we'll see how that plays out. It's going to not be super smooth for ads, but we'll see. It will turn out pretty well for podcast listeners.
Yeah, and by the way, the timestamp thing Stephen was talking about, I was quoting from his YouTube video. We'll link. You can watch the video, which is also a podcast. He has a YouTube version of his podcast. So do we, except his YouTube version is video because he's a YouTuber, and our YouTube version is just audio because we're a podcast only. Anyway, we do publish ATP on YouTube for people who want to listen there, and we do translate the chapter markers into the format that YouTube wants, which is they just want in the description of your video, they just want timestamp, word, timestamp, you know. So if you look at the description of all of our videos, what you will see is the description is, go here for the show notes, and then timestamp, chapter name, and YouTube parses that and implements chapters. So the YouTube version of ATP does in fact have chapters, but of course it's only the public version because there's no way to do a member-only one without, I believe, paying Google a cut.
Yeah. Of course. We got some interesting news from Tim Hardwick at Mac Rumors. This is kind of regurgitating what Mark Gurman said. Apple is working on a revamped M6 Pro and M6 Max MacBook Pro with an OLED display, thinner chassis, and touch support. But maybe it was curious that Gurman didn't say anything about the MacBook Pro with just the vanilla M6 chip.
Yeah, I wonder if that's an omission, but it's worth... I've just put this here now because I feel like Tim at Mac Rumors is maybe reading a bit much into it, but it's worth considering. It's true that when Gurman talked about this, he only talked about the Pro and the Max models and did not talk about the plain, no suffix M6 getting a new thinner chassis and an OLED screen or whatever. Would Apple bifurcate the MacBook Pro line into the two good ones with the Pro and the Max and an OLED screen and a touch screen and a thin chassis, and then the no suffix one doesn't get an OLED screen, doesn't get a thinner chassis, doesn't get touch? That would be really weird, but if it's right, to get credit to Tim.
It's also extremely, is precedented a word? Do we know?
Yeah, okay. It is.
I'm very heartened to hear that. It's very precedented nice. Because there's been lots of times over the years when the least expensive computer named MacBook Pro in the lineup was pretty different from the others. You know, obviously, currently, it's not that different. It is a little different, but it's not that different currently. Even before the M4 generation, there were more limitations on, like, ports and monitors and stuff, right? Or was it the M3 that had that?
Yeah, no, it's usually the unsuffix M chip isn't as capable as the suffixed one. So, yes, there were differences in, like, external monitor support,
yeah,
and
Thunderbolt bandwidth.
And obviously the unsuffixed one usually had one fan instead of two, so that was an internal difference.
Yeah, the entire internals are laid out differently usually. And so, yeah, there's all those differences. And then before this entire, you know, body style of the MacBook Pro, you had the MacBook Escape, the one that didn't have the touch bar. That, you know, and that I think is kind of maybe comparable, you know, in Apple's eyes to something like having OLED versus not. And then before that whole era of like those unibody body ones, you had the MD-101, the one that had like the optical drive forever, in like long after optical drives were gone from the lineup. Didn't the MD-101 have that? Was that the one before that even? But anyway, like you've had. Frequently in Apple's lineup of MacBook Pros, you have like the one that's like $1,200 to $1,400 that is stripped down or is an older generation, but businesses and schools and stuff keep buying a whole bunch of them. So Apple keeps selling them and they make a bunch of money from that getting older but still being sold. So I can totally see a plausible path here where if they're about to, you know, do some pretty big component updates and maybe a design update to the MacBook Pro higher end models, you can totally see modern Apple saying, all right, we're going to keep this the cheapest model, we're going to keep that on the old design, maybe for possibly years to come. And we're going to have the higher end models, which we make more money on. We can help pay for that OLED screen and, you know, help justify the case redesign with those higher margins. So this is extremely plausible. Now, we don't actually know that they're actually going to do this. It could just be that, like, Gurman only heard about the Pro and Max. So, like, the absence of Gurman mentioning something doesn't really mean that that is also absent in the reality of the thing. So we'll see how this goes, but that is extremely plausible because Apple's done it a lot in the past.
All right, let's talk Tahoe and Electron apps. Dayton Lowell writes, apparently Discord is using a custom forked version of Electron and they cherry picked the fix. It's in the shipping version right now.
Baffled have, by the JS prefix
oh,
again.
God damn it again.
Fourth time.
I know. I will get it one day. I will get it one day. Let me just reboot the whole fucking thing. God damn it.
No,
I'm
you're
sick.
Fine. You
I'm
sick. Clean, give yourself a clean edit point. Just say also. Just start with that.
I'm sick. Stop making fun of me. All right.
Never.
Pull it together, Casey. Pull it together. Also, Discord has since updated the app such that the Electron version detector no longer flags it.
It's nice, yeah. I'd forgotten about that. The cherry picking the fix is a Git parlance, or maybe predates Git, but it's basically like they have they have their own custom version of Electron that has some changes to it, and rather than updating Electron to the new version that has the fix that we're talking about that doesn't slow down in Tahoe, they just take the code that implements the thing that avoids that bug and stick it into their custom version. So there's a GitHub issue where they did that. But anyway, since then, they seem to have actually fully upgraded to a newer version of Electron, and so now the Tahoe detector app does no longer flags Discord as being a problem, but it wasn't actually a problem before. That's the limitation of this AppleScript thing that checks whether you have Electron apps that might have this bug. All they can go on is, does this app have Electron and what version number is it? But they can't tell. Like, it's not going to rummage the binary to see if it has the problem.
Then Adam 1 adds, the reason Microsoft Teams Classic has that crappy older Electron version is that development has ended for the classic version of Teams. So that software will never be updated and is wasting space on your SSD. Time to delete that less than wonderful software. I won't be shedding any tears.
Yep, I deleted it.
All right. I don't know why this... Often, when we record the show, we get feedback about something that I either knew or intended to say, and then the conversation moves on, and it would be weird to bring it back around. This is a Casey problem. This is not a listener problem. This is a me problem. But I full well knew that the following was the thing, and I don't know
me
why
too.
I didn't bring it up.
I use it all the time.
Right, exactly. I don't know why neither of us brought it up. But anyways,
no, I mean, maybe it didn't seem that relevant, but the reason I put it in follow-up is because if you are not like me and Casey and are fully aware of this, it's good information to know,
yeah,
so that's why
agreed.
It's here.
So Matt Rigby writes, with regard to emoji picking in macOS, you can summon the buggy macOS emoji picker by hitting Control and Command and Space, and it will automatically suggest emoji based on the last word you typed, similar to Launch Bar.
This is Marco saying that he uses Launch Bar to quickly look up and put in an emoji. I didn't mention to Marco because obviously he likes the way Launch Bar does it. He's not looking for an alternate solution or something, but just FYI. The built-in picker has, and the built-in picker also has two modes, which is like the small palette that has just like recent stuff or whatever, and then the expanded one. And I think it remembers that state. So sometimes you might do the expanded thing and then it's not small anymore, but you can switch it back. But anyway, Control, Command, Space. Try it in a decent Mac app that uses like native text controls, and you'll get a nice emoji picker. You can also go to the menus and select insert special character or whatever. I think it's a standard menu in most Mac apps.
Yeah, and I was glad to hear this. I actually did not know about this, so it was news to me. So thank you. However, I find it really clunky, and it is both slower and it takes more keystrokes and just is generally a little bit more
friction. It brings
up
a UI that you then have to interact with versus like a Launch Bar type thing, which is like, I just get to keep my fingers on my keyboard, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like I can type Command Space, GRIM, there we go. It's already a grimacing face. Enter. Done. Like, and if, you know, otherwise, all right, Control, Command Space, GRIM, no, that's death.
And you got to figure out, what do I do to select then, the one that I found?
Yeah,
do I click on
like,
it? Do I double click on it?
Yeah,
does double clicking on it insert it, but not make the palette go away?
Exactly. Like it's more work. It's more friction. So like if Launch Bar stopped working and no other such app could possibly provide something like this, sure, okay, I'd start using the system one. But as long as this better version exists, I'm going to keep using it. And that's what all these apps are. Like the system offers. Search via Spotlight. You can type in something and type in an app name and hit enter and launch the app. The system now offers clipboard history if you upgrade to Tahoe, and you can, or to 26, whatever. Yeah, Tahoe. I always lose track. Even this soon.
It's
after
the current
the
OS.
I know. So the OS has offered a standard or basic version of these app launchers functionality for a while, but we use these app launchers because we think they're better. or they're faster, or they have more capabilities, or they kind of just fit our mental model, or they fit our muscle memory better. So yeah, I'm going to keep using the launch bar, but if I ever can't, I'll look at my options then.
Wasn't there an app that you used to use, Casey, called like Rocket or something?
That's right.
That did the same thing?
Yeah, it's very similar.
Do you not use that anymore?
No, I do. Basically, I think by default, you type colon. I have switched it to semicolon. I don't remember why I did this, but I did this years ago. And so you type semicolon in basically any text entry field anywhere on the Mac and start typing the name of the emoji, like grimacing is a great example. So semicolon, or I should say colon, actually, by default. So colon, G-R-I-M, and then it'll filter down to grimace, you know, or grimacing emoji, whatever it's called. And I really like Rocket. It's not perfect, but it's very, very affordable. I don't remember how much I paid for it, and I paid for it like 85 years ago. And it's fast, and it works. So I really recommend it. We'll put a link in the show notes. All right, let's talk Pogo Stick Robot. So this was from Overtime last week, and we were talking about the Neo household quote-unquote robot. And John, you had brought up that there was some like Pogo Stick Robot sort of situation, and you couldn't let it lie, so you did a little research. What did you find?
Yeah, I was trying to remember, trying to find, actually. I did after we finished, so I tried to actually find this. That episode of the PBS series Nova that was about robotic stuff in like the 80s or 90s, and it showed this pogo stick robot. I was describing how like that was so clearly a breakthrough to my, when I saw that, I'm like, they're on the right track with how to make things that move around. Like it has to be able to be like off balance and self-correcting, you know? And I talked about the scary Boston Dynamics robot dogs that we've seen in the modern era and everything. I couldn't find the Nova episode, but I did find a YouTube video. I think it's like some kind of British thing. I think the narrator is British. Showing the Pogo robot. So we'll put a link in the show notes to a YouTube video. You want to see the Pogo robot I was thinking of? This will show it, even though it's not the Nova episode. And apparently that robot was from something called the MIT Leg Lab, founded by Mark Raybert in the 1980s. And they created that Pogo robot. And Mark Raybert would go on to found Boston Dynamics. So, kind of makes sense that I saw that Pogo robot. I'm like, they're on the right track. And then now we have Boston Dynamics. This is literally the same guy. So check it out if you want to see what pogo stick robots were like in the 80s.
It all comes full circle. And then finally, we have Trey Carpenter writes, my mother-in-law butt dials me all the time. What we figured out is that she makes a call from favorites. The other person hangs up first. My name is where the hang up button is in her favorites. Happens 2 times a week.
I tested this. Many, many people sent this in. This is not just Trey writing in that this is definitely this can happen. I tried it myself. If this is what my parents are doing, it would make sense. But lots of people's parents and siblings and friends
and their
are apparently doing this, because if you lose the hang up race, which you're like, oh, where is that red X button? And, you know, you go to press it. This is another thing like the coyote time stuff we talked about. Like lots of people suggested this. In fact, I think this exact issue was suggested at that time of like game programming techniques for user interfaces to make them feel better or be less error prone. And one of the ideas is when you just transition a screen, like there used to be a full screen overlay showing like the call and like the red X button and everything like that, but the other person hangs up and suddenly that overlay goes away, revealing the phone app beneath it with maybe your list of favorites or whatever, ignore all taps for the next 300 milliseconds or something to make it so that if you see, because it takes a while for your brain to go, I'm going to hit the red button. Then it sends nerve impulses down your arm and to your hand. And then your finger has to start moving, and then it has to move and move and move and hit that. Like that is a large amount of time to the computer. And it would be great if there could be a little bit of forgiveness for when the screen transitions and just ignore any taps after that. On the other hand, if you have lightning fast reflexes and the second the screen changes, you hit the button and it doesn't register, you're like, this phone feels broken. But I do feel like in this case, butt dialing mitigation is worthwhile for that extra delay. I mean, they already do delay stuff like that with the, it has to tell whether you've double tapped the side button. So the first tap of the side button doesn't count until it has waited X number of milliseconds to see if there's another tap coming.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's it. Okay. So like I said at the top of the show, I was really sick the last couple of days. And
is this what caused the illness?
Well, maybe, I don't know.
Was it CDRs?
But I woke up. Yeah, it was CDRs. No, I woke up, what was this, yesterday, I believe, as we record this, and there was, like, some sort of weird, like, sock-looking purse thing that Apple announced, and they dropped this, I think, first thing in the morning, and I genuinely thought that this was a gag.
Me too!
That this was not real, and that
kind of like another announcement Apple made long ago that people thought was a gag.
Perhaps, yes, we will talk about that. But no, reading from Apple
Newsroom, I'm 100% with you. When I first breezed by this, it was, I think it was like early in the morning or something, or like I had just woken up from a nap or something. I was like a little bit tired and I hadn't been near the computer for a while, and I was kind of catching up on whatever had happened, and I scrolled past that and I got the same instinctual feeling in my mind as I do on April 1st, and I'm scrolling through the news and I see some weird thing and I just instantly classified it as, oh, that's a parody, that's a joke. Like, I just kept going, and I saw the same thing like three times from different people as I'm scrolling up, and I'm like, oh, wait a minute. And then I saw one of the link previews and it said apple.com, and I'm like, oh no.
Yep.
Is this real? And sure enough.
So Issey Miyake and Apple today unveiled iPhone Pocket, inspired by the concept of a piece of cloth. Let me read that one more time, because this is verbatim. Inspired by the concept of a piece of cloth, its singular 3D knitted construction is designed to fit any iPhone as well as all pocketable items. Beginning Friday, November 14th, it will be available at select Apple locations and on Apple.com. iPhone Pocket is the short strap design. In the short strap design, retails at $150 American, and the long strap design at $230 American for a mankini.
Yeah, well, to describe what this looks like, it's like a long sort of pleated, like the pleated part of the sock when you pull up your socks. It's a long version of that with like a slit in it, and you can put the phone into that. It's closed at the bottom. It's not bent like a sock. It's just like a big rectangle with a slit in it that you can shove a phone into. And everyone immediately, especially older people, said, that reminds me of iPod socks. Well, one person, Paul Kafasa, said it reminded him of a mankini, and he did a blog post with... Who's that, Borat?
Yep, the Borat swimsuit. Oh my God, yeah. What a perfect analogy that was.
Yeah, I think you could actually wear this like that. I think it might actually work. As Paul says, someone can feel free to try it.
All right, John, what's it going to take?
Oh, no, that's not going to happen.
I think you're the only one among
the
us
level
who has
of body
a Borat
might be
build.
Similar.
And yeah, I mean, I'll tell you one thing. I couldn't pull that off, but I bet you could.
I don't think anybody can pull that off. That's the thing with the mankini. Anyway, iPod socks were a thing that was released in 2004. I didn't get the YouTube link in here. There was a good YouTube link to Jobs introducing the iPod socks. When they were introduced, even the people who were in the room with Steve Jobs thought it was a joke, because he very often has a slide in a presentation and it would be like, oh, we did this, and it shows like an iPod with a rotary dial on it for the iPhone. We all know that's a joke. When he did the iPod socks, you can hear the room like laughing and tittering and not being like, this is a joke, right? And then eventually realizing as he goes on to the next slides that it's not a joke. They released socks, again, not like foot-shaped socks, but just basically like a tube. The tube part of a sock that's closed on one end for you to put your iPod in. This was in 2004, and you could get six of these. They came in a package of six in different colors for $30. They're currently selling for $40 to $80 on eBay, by the way. They may go up with this thing. So the Issey Miyake thing, obviously that's a designer thing. Gruber had a post about this. Issey Miyake is the person who designed the black turtleneck, the signature black turtleneck that Steve Jobs used to wear that everybody parodies. The actual guy, Issey Miyake, died a while ago, but the company lives on. But the thing is, it's high fashion. In the world of high fashion, like, we complain about Apple's RAM prices, but in the world of high fashion, everything costs a huge amount of money, because there is really no connection between the cost of manufacturing or materials and the price. The price is the price, and it has to do with brand and image and fashion, and absolutely nothing to do with what the things are made of or how they're made or anything like that. So this is just a piece of cloth. Why is it $150? Two words, Issey Miyake. Like, it's just like Calvin Klein or Louis Vuitton, or like, it's fashion. So I have no, those bands, that you're not paying that much because they're made of special leather that costs $1 billion. It's because they're a fancy brand. So this is the same thing. Why does this seem to exist? Why is Apple need to make it? Obviously, they probably have some relationship with Issey Miyake. Whatever. I don't care. Some fashion people want to spend $250 on a sock for their phone. Go for it. I don't care. I will say that it's easier to get your phone in and out of this than it is for the crossbody strap that Apple made for less money. So it has that going for it. But yeah, iPod socks definitely seemed a lot more cozy. You got six of them for $30. It was one of the rare, amazing deals in Apple land. And you know why? Because Apple, in 2004, was not Issey Miyake or MS or any of these other companies. Apple was just Apple, and they made the iPod, and the iPhone didn't exist yet. And they weren't yet the Apple of today, so they could sell you socks for $30. And it seemed kind of expensive, like $30 for the top portion of six socks. But I can tell you, as someone who's bought socks recently, in 2025, regular men's socks... $30 for six of them is actually a pretty good deal.
Yeah, the original iPod socks were, like, of course we all made fun of them at the time, they were also delightful. They were great. And in fact, we actually, we own a set. At some point, Tiff got an iPod. I got her an iPod Mini as an early gift in our relationship. In fact, it was the first iPod I ever bought, was one for Tiff. And I got her, at some point later that year, I got her the box of iPod socks. And she kept it in the, I think it was the teal one that she used. She kept it in the iPod sock for most of the time she owned it. It was delightful, and we still have the rest of them, like, in a box somewhere in my closet. Delightful. This thing, like, look, this is harmless. Apple did a fashion collab with a fashion house that, you know, they're going to sell a couple hundred of these things, maybe. Like, they're not going to sell a ton of them. It's fine. However, I will say, if any of our listeners buy one of these, I would love to see it worn like Borat, because John won't do it.
Wow. It's gonna stretch it out too much. No, you're right. I won't do it.
Some YouTuber will probably do it, but like, yeah, someone's got to spend the $200 to get that for that picture.
Gosh, I hope not.
Yeah, all right. But look, it's fine. Like, there's all sorts of, so, and what we've been told, apparently, like, I saw a few things breeze by on Mastodon and stuff, that like, apparently, similar types of things have been, you know, getting some traction in different markets, usually not in the US, which is why a lot of us like haven't heard about it, but similar types of things have gotten traction, similar to like the crossbody strap. When that came out, you know, a few months ago with the phone, everyone's like, yeah, okay, good job, Apple. You're taking, you know, you're kind of entering a market that was already proven in certain other markets. Like, okay, fine. I'm sure this thing will be fine. It'll go in like, you know, the dustbin of Apple history with like weird things they've made in small volumes for a lot of money, like gold Apple watches and the Made in Apple book, the Johnny Ive, the Design by Apple in California book, like stuff like that. Like, they occasionally make weird stuff in small batches. Okay, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's silly and I don't really understand it, but I don't understand fashion. So,
oh, if we can get a picture of somebody wearing one of these Borat style while also wearing a gold Apple watch.
Wow.
And maybe, I mean, maybe AI can help us with this. And then also, like, carrying a MacBook in that $300 MacBook leather sleeve they made about.
That $300 leather sleeve sounds like a bargain now with $250 piece of cotton, right? Sock or whatever this thing is. At least that thing's leather.
In front of them, a coffee table with Designed by Apple in California.
Yeah,
in
front of that book. I've got one of those. It's great.
The large version.
Large version is too big to fit on shelves. One cute thing from the iPod sock announcement with Steve Jobs is a sign of the times, different times technology-wise, was that he mentioned, and it will also keep your iPod warm. The idea of putting your phone in something to keep it warm is not common. Now, I know phones don't like to be super cold, and people who live in very, very cold climates say, well, actually, I do have to keep my phone warm. But the thing is, iPods did not really produce that much heat, especially in 2004. And many of them, including the one in the picture, had mechanical hard drives in them. And so keeping them warm, even in mildly chilly winter temperatures, was probably a good idea. So the sock was actually performing a function to keep things warm. But I don't see them selling, for example, a MacBook Pro case that's designed to keep your MacBook Pro warm. Unless, again, you're using it outdoors on a film shoot or something. But, you know.
I mean, in all fairness, I think most MacBook Pro cases do keep it warm. It's probably not something you want, but it is something that happens.
It depends. You know, someone's going to write and say, we are shooting these videos in Alaska and we need to keep our MacBook Pros warm.
All right. So John did me personally a great favor by adding a whole bunch of information about some new gaming hardware releases that I have no opinions on. So I'm just going to check out for the next half hour. And let me give you a better edit point. Hello. Okay. Goodbye, future Marco. So I'm just going to check out for the next half hour. And you got this, John.
Well, you're recovering from illness anyway, but still, I think you might have some interest in some of the stuff. So this was this came and swept away all of our other topics. At first, I was going to save it till next week, but I think it's of the moment. It was announced yesterday, I believe. Valve announced the company behind the Steam store. We used to say Valve, the company behind Half-Life and
yeah,
Portal,
back when they
whatever,
used to make
but now
games.
We just say Valve, the company behind Steam, which is where people buy PC games. They have an existing hardware product called the Steam Deck, and they have a VR headset called the Valve Index or something.
Yep.
Anyway, they made it, and they have had some other hardware over time. They made a big announcement where they're releasing a bunch of new hardware products, and they're very interesting. But before I get into the products, I want to just give a brief aside about Valve doing this and how it's how it's different. Yeah, that's another one. How are things different than when you were young, John? Well, here we go.
Great.
To be clear, what Valve's hardware does, like the Steam Deck, for instance. The Steam Deck is a handheld gaming thing, and it plays quote-unquote PC games that are sold through Steam. And by PC games, we mean games that run on Windows PCs running on x86 processors. And the Steam Deck runs them, but it doesn't run Windows. And it doesn't have an x86 processor. Actually, no, but it does have an x86 processor. Sorry, I'm getting confused with another product. Anyway, it doesn't run Windows. It runs, I believe it's even on the Steam Deck, it's called SteamOS. It's just a Linux variant. It's like, how are they running Windows games? Windows, quote-unquote, PC games on Linux. And as we've discussed in the past when talking about Apple similar technology, they have a thing that I think they call it Proton that's like a translation layer that understands the like DirectX API calls or whatever inside a Windows x86 binary and translates them to calls into their own Linux native library for doing 3D stuff. And in that way, they are able to sell a platform that plays games made to run on Windows, but they don't license Windows and they don't have to, you know, be involved with Microsoft in any way. And this has been going on for years. And obviously also there's the Steam Store, which is an online store where you can buy games. You can even buy games for the Mac there, some games for the Mac, that has become incredibly dominant. And the way that a lot of people buy games, it was one of the very early app stores, even before the iPhone, I believe. You can check my math on that. Because it makes real easy to install games. You go to like an app store like experience, so you run the Steam app, there's a bunch of games, you can buy them, you put a credit card in. It's like the app store, but before the app store and for PC games. The PC games used to be a pain in the butt to install, and they would fight with each other, and Steam like made it so, don't worry about it. If it's in the app store, it's in the Steam store, you just click install, give us your money, and it'll install, and it'll be great.
What got me sold on Steam back then was the lack of all the stupid copy protection crap that the
like the App Store. You don't have to deal with that.
Yeah, it was great. Like you could just like download the game. First of all, you don't have to like go to a store and buy a disc, and then you wouldn't have the disc constantly checking it for self for disc protection and all that crap. And then like if you went like somewhere else, like your friend's house, you could log in and just download the game there. And as long as you weren't playing it at the same time as you were on your home computer, you could play your games there. It was incredible.
It's like the App Store. When you get a new phone, you sign into the App Store, you can download all your apps. You don't have to like enter serial numbers for all your apps.
Yeah, all the activation crap that was like, because copy protection was getting so advanced and therefore also burdensome and invasive back then. Because like, you know, basically CDRs did a number on game sales because S-tier. Again, S-tier.
The good thing, all those CDRs are now bad, so you can't play those copies anymore.
Yeah, but there were so many, because look, I used to pirate games a lot. Of course, I was a teenager back then. And like, there were so many like weird tricks they would do, like, all right, we're going to store like this protection data in like this weird sub channel of the
CD. They did that on floppy disks too, by the way.
Of course, yeah. And then of course then you'd have, you know, apps that would be able to rip that sub channel data, and then burners that would be able to burn it, and you have to, okay, you got to get this version of Nero burning ROM to rip the disk and then burn it with this one Plextor CD writer. Like it was this whole thing. And then as a result of, you know, that cat and mouse game, the copy protection got so invasive. It started basically being like a rootkit on your computer, and there were all these different schemes that different companies would use, and it was a nightmare to both try to be a pirate during that time and also to be a regular customer during that time.
Yeah, because you had to deal with all the stuff that was meant to make pirates' lives more miserable, but it made your life more miserable too.
Yeah, it was awful. And then Steam comes in and is like, all that's gone. We're going to do online activation-based DRM, which worked just fine, but it was way less invasive. There was no more like physical.
Yeah, they were ahead of their time with the you're only sell them digitally. You can't get a disc, and you have to be online. I'm never going to use a service that makes you have to be online.
Yeah, that was controversial at the time. People did say that
because it was a long time ago.
So much better now.
Right, and so the thing that strikes me and has always struck me about Steam and doing all this is that the Microsoft of my youth would never have allowed this. Because the Microsoft of my youth, the Microsoft before it lost an antitrust case against the US and had all the baggage, when it was the dominant company in the dominant thing, which was personal computers, all before mobile, before all of that, that Microsoft would never have allowed another company to make and sell a platform where you could run Windows games that didn't give Microsoft any money, that didn't run Windows, that didn't need Microsoft's permission. And you know how they would solve this problem? How would they not allow it? they would constantly be modifying their APIs in such a way that it would break the Proton layer. And I'm not saying they haven't done that. I bet they probably have. But they would leverage their strength by saying, if company, we will only license Windows to you if you promise to never do business with Valve in any way. And like, they would, like, we will only let you ship your game on Windows if you promise you will put in this code that will cause it to not function on Steam. Because Valve is selling hardware and selling games through their own app store, and that runs apps not made for their operating system. They're selling hardware with Linux on it. These games are not Linux games. They're Windows games. Developers are making Windows games, and Valve is like, we're just going to make them work. We're going to make a compatibility layer. We're going to certify that they work. If they don't work, we're going to tweak our compatibility layer so that they do work. And it's like, that's not going to work. That's not tenable. And Valve has shown it is tenable. They can do it. And Microsoft, probably because they've been chastened by their antitrust case, probably because the PC is not that important of a platform, so they just ignore it, has allowed them to exist and expand. So much so that Microsoft is currently, over the past several years, deciding whether or not they still want to do that whole Xbox thing. And the answer, by the way, seems to be no, they don't really. They entered the console space. They did amazingly well for years and years. But they're not the top of the console space. The highest they probably got was a 360, and they've had a bunch of poor choices since then. They seem to be getting out of that. But they still make PC games. But Valve was coming and say, oh, hey, Microsoft, you're getting out of the Xbox space, and you're just going to do PC games? Well, guess what? We essentially own the PC gaming space. We don't run Windows. We don't care what you do. And it's weird that people are still writing games for x86 Windows, but we can run them on our Linux platform, and gamers seem to like it fine. And they buy them through our store. And our store is the only gaming store that matters, even though you have your own store. So sorry about that. And now, with these announcements, you'll see they're basically looking to fill the gap that will eventually be left by Microsoft either radically changing and de-emphasizing the Xbox or abandoning it entirely. Sorry for this big long preamble, but here's what they announced. So the first is this thing called the Steam Controller. They've made a controller before. Do you remember the one with the big touchpads on it, like the round touchpads? I think it was also called the Steam Controller. I used it and didn't like it. But anyway, it's a handheld controller. It just looks like a Xbox or PlayStation controller, but it's got two big square touchpads on it. Most of the things that they do, like their Steam controllers, are made for quote-unquote PC games, which means they expect you to have a mouse. So the controller has to have some equivalent way to use a mouse. Same thing with the Steam Deck. Steam Deck also has two big square touchpads on either side of it because these games are made to use with a mouse cursor. They're PC games. And so you need a touchpad to basically be, you know, to be the mouse cursor on a system that doesn't have a mouse cursor. This controller works with any PC or device running Steam. So that includes a Mac running Steam, a PC running Steam, any of the hardware that we're going to talk about, or the Steam Link app. This includes Mac, Windows, Linux PCs, as well as tablets and smartphones. So this is just like a controller that will work with anything. It's got infrared LEDs that will make it trackable by the VR thing that we're going to talk about in a second. It's got magnetic sticks. So I think we talked about this on a past episode. The technologies for how little joysticks on controllers work, even today, like the PlayStation, I think also the plain Xbox one, the controllers use sticks that have things rubbing up against each other inside them. And anything that rubs up against each other, if you use it long enough, the rubbing will cause, you know, friction and damage, and it will stop working. And so you get things like stick drift in the Nintendo Switch because things wear out over time. There are technologies that allow joysticks to work without things that touch each other. One of them are the Hall effect sensors, which use, I don't know, we'll put a link to the difference between the Hall effect and the thing we're about to talk about. But they things don't actually touch. They just pass by each other and through magnetic fields or whatever determines where the stick's pointing. The Steam controller uses TMR, which is tunnel magnetoresistance, which is slightly more accurate than Hall effect and a little bit better. Again, there'll be a link in the show notes about these details. But the point is, Steam controller, they're using the very best kind of like joystick thumbstick technology that is available today that will last the longest. The Steam controller, like everything else we're going to talk about, no pricing released, but pricing probably won't be too bad. 30 to 40 hour battery life, a magnetically attaching combo charger and wireless dongle. So there's a little magnetic thing. It's really neat. Like if you just sort of like slide the controller, I don't know how to describe this. If you leave the little magnetic charging thing flat on your desk, and you put the controller flat on your desk, and then you just slide the controller along the desk towards the magnetic thing will leap from the desk surface and stick to the underside of the controller. It's very neat. And that magnetic thing that charges it is also the wireless dongle that you has a cord that plugs into the back of your thing for the like low latency wireless signal. So that's the Steam controller. Neat. It, I think it looks kind of uncomfortable to use, but you got to have some compromises for to be able to use PC games on it. Second thing they're releasing is called the Steam Machine, which is a 6-inch black cube that is... Oh, I should have got these images. 6-inch black cube. It's a gaming PC. It's a small form factor gaming PC and a 6-inch black cube. And I had some pictures of what is on the inside of this thing that I will try to find. But it's pretty nice looking inside. Like, it's a small form factor PC, but not one that you made yourself. It is... it looks almost kind of like something Apple would make. When you open it up, there is just a massive single fan that's like probably 6 inches in diameter. That's one fan pulling through, and the whole rest of the thing is filled with like heat sink that the fan is pulling air through. It's pretty neat. It looks like a little black cube. People are making parodies of it by putting a Next logo on it, even though it doesn't really look like the Next cube. But it is a small form factor PC. It has an internal power supply. It has an LED strip on the front that's like customizable, and the thing they described was like, say you want to download a game on Steam, but it's taking a while to download, which probably won't take too long because they use peer-to-peer downloading. It's really fast. But anyway, if you have this Steam machine hooked up to your TV, you can just go watch a TV show or something, and you'll be able to see on the LED strip like a progress bar, like whether your download is done or not, without having it take over the screen.
That's super cool.
And you can, it's all customizable because, again, it's a PC. They emphasize that it's a PC. It runs Steam OS 3, which is an ARC-based Linux, ARCH-based Linux with KDE Plasma as their desktop environment. Here's a quote from their marketing material. Steam Machine is optimized for gaming, but it's still your PC. Install your own apps or even another operating system. Who are we to tell you how to use your computer?
I love this line so much when I saw it.
Very on Apple. I mean, they've always been like this because they're a PC company, and they're like, look, this is just a PC. Like, we're not going to say, like, it looks like a little console. What I'm getting is, like, this looks like an Xbox. It is a little cube. It plays, quote-unquote, PC games, but it's not sold as a personal computer. But it is, and they're like, look, it's a computer. Like, you can, like, you want to install Windows on it? Go ahead. That'll work fine. Do whatever you want with it. It is a cute, small four-factor PC. Another bit from the marketing. Steam Machine keeps cool and runs whisper quiet, even when running the most demanding games. And the measurement I saw in some YouTube videos was 28 to 30 decibels.
That's awesome.
A cute little small form factor gaming dedicated PC. The performance they describe as, quote, 4K gaming at 60 frames per second with FSR, which is one of those technologies that does like upscaling or whatever. So it's not going to do native 4K 60 frames per second, but you won't notice the difference. The specs, it has a what they describe as a semi-custom AMD Zen 4 processor with they say 6C12T, 6-core, 12-thread, I guess, up to 4.8 gigahertz, 30 watts TDP. They describe it as having more than 6 times the performance of the Steam Deck. So I'm assuming this AMD Zen processor thing, I'm assuming it's like one of those AMD CPU-GPU combos, kind of like what the PlayStation has. But it's an x86 CPU and a GPU. It comes with 16 gigs of RAM. Your choices for storage are 512 or 2 terabytes. It has a micro SD card slot, a Wi-Fi 6E, Bluetooth 5.3, a dedicated antenna for the Steam controllers built into the Steam Cube. So you don't need that the dongle thing. DisplayPort is 4K at up to 240 hertz or 8K at 60 hertz. Supports HDR FreeSync and daisy chaining. HDMI 2.0 port at 4K at 120 hertz supports HDR FreeSync and CEC. Everyone loves CEC. It's got 2 USB-A 3.2 ports, 1 USB-C 3.2 Gen 2 port, and 2 USB-A 2.0 ports and gigabit Ethernet. Again, no pricing. But this, you're like, so is this an Xbox? Is this a game console? It is the Steam Deck is a quote-unquote handheld PC. You can run, quote-unquote, PC games on the Steam Deck. You download them from Steam. They're games designed to run on Windows, and they run on Linux on this handheld thing. This is the non-handheld version of the Steam Deck. And, of course, it's more powerful. It's a tiny little PC. It's a cute little box. You can connect it to your TV just like you would connect an Xbox to your TV, just like you connect a PlayStation to your TV. But it's a PC. So it's kind of like a Steam console. Like, is Valve is going to replace Xbox as the third company, or are they just going to come to dominate the PC gaming space? Because most people don't want to build a gaming PC. I know I don't. Like, they just want to play PC games because PC games are good. That's where, you know, PC games are made, are more complicated, have more features, require a mouse and a keyboard often. And here's Valve out here with the dominant PC gaming store selling a handheld PC that you can play games on. And now a non-handheld PC that you can play games on that looks a lot like a game console. And they also will sell their own controller. I'm fascinated by this. Again, no pricing. The guess for people looking at this is that it's not going to be super expensive because it is not a super powerful gaming PC. Again, it's a 6-inch cube. It's going to be like game console caliber power. But I think it will also be game console caliber ease of use, which is really important. Like, Marco, you just talked about all the things that you liked about Steam and how annoying PC gaming was. The Steam Deck has the same advantage. It's a dedicated piece of hardware. You don't need anything but the Steam Deck. You sign into your Steam account. You download your games. You buy new games. They play. You know they're going to play on it because it's made by the same company. Like, it's pretty compelling. And in the same way, you're like, oh, should I build a PC? Should I build a little PC and hook it up to my TV? Should I go to PC Parts Picker and start designing my small form factor PC and make sure that it doesn't overheat and has the right blah, blah, blah? Or should I just buy a Steam Machine? Steam Machine, something like this, is the closest I've ever gotten to considering having a gaming PC in my house. It's not even out yet, by the way. But I'm looking at this and going, you know, this would solve a lot of problems I have. In particular, I have no place for a gaming PC, but this thing is a freaking 6-inch cube. And I could put it right next to my PlayStation and connect it to the same monitor and use the same controller. So I have some interest in this. Do either one of you have any interest in this cute little cube?
So by coincidence, I have one right here. No, just kidding. but close. A few months ago, I bought a small form factor gaming PC for our house here because Tiff and Adam were basically like, you know, everybody wanted one more PC in the house. And at this point, almost all of our Razer laptops are dead except for mine, the one that I repaired, put in all the new stuff in. The others are all dead. And so Tiff wanted her own gaming PC for here. And so I, like, there was this company that I found on Amazon that basically sells almost like shoebox sized, you know, little, it's like, it's basically, it can fit a full size graphics card and then everything else is kind of tiny around it. So it looks almost like a PCIe enclosure, but it's the full computer in there. Anyway, so we bought one of those, and it is currently connected to the TV with wires running across the living room for the keyboard, and there's like a gamepad style controller on it. And Tiff uses it to play some old games, and it's totally fine. But if the Valve thing was out, I would have definitely bought that instead because it is way smaller. And it will have like, you know, the Steam OS kind of, you know, like the shell and the software environment that
it's
made.
Meant to be used on a TV like a console. Like, it's not exactly. You're not going to see like the Windows Explorer. Like, it's running Linux. Like, it's its own operating system made so you hook this thing up to your TV, sit on the couch with a controller, and you launch Steam and launch your games.
Right. So there's no question in my mind that if that was available at that time, we would have bought that instead.
I just put a link in the document. We'll try to put in the notes to the Verge article that has an image carousel showing the internals. It's a huge heat sink, a huge fan, and everything else. It looks very Apple-like on the inside. Maybe not quite as neat and beautiful as the Apple stuff, but it is extremely well-designed little PC. I forgot to mention, in addition to the customizable LED strip in the front, it also has, very much like various Xboxes have, a replaceable magnetically attaching faceplate. So you can have different faceplates and brand them and put stickers on them and have color ones or whatever. The default one is a cute little, you know, black cube, but that front part can be replaced with third-party stuff or anything you want. So that's pretty neat as well. I'm very interested in this machine, although basically my PS5 looks like my PS5 is an AMD combo CPU GPU with an SSD and RAM and connected to with a Linux-based operating system connected to a store where I download games. Like, that's what my PlayStation is. The difference is my PlayStation plays PlayStation games and this thing plays quote-unquote PC games, which how long before they're called Steam games or Valve games or something? Because yeah. like I guess they're still PC games. Like, they're emphasizing like, look, gamers can build their own monster gaming PC, and that will run all these games too. But it's just weird to me that developers are making games. Presumably they're developing on Windows machines. They're testing on Windows. And then how many of their users are running their games not on Windows? It's fascinating.
Yeah.
This is not something I have a need for today, but it would. It's only a matter of time before Declan discovers PC gaming.
Like, yeah, Declan may have a need for this.
Right. I don't plan to bring this into our world, but you know, he will find out and he will want it. And if we do go down this path, this seems like a great answer.
It's better than building your own gaming PC, for sure. Like, if your kid wants to just play PC games and you don't have to think about it, you just buy this thing, plug it in. Like, even if you just hook it up to, like, a monitor in his room or hook it up to your TV or something, like, you can treat it like a console. And that's, yeah. And, you know, who knows? Price performance-wise, people go, oh, I could build a small form factor PC that's 10 times as fast. You probably could.
You always could.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, like that's yes, of course you can. This is for Apple buyers. This is for people who don't want to do that and who either don't have the time or don't have the skill or want the more integrated experience that this will offer. And that's a good size market.
And the beauty is, as I'm sure Valve would tell you, is say you build your small form factor PC, or say you build your monster PC. You can install on it SteamOS, which is free. And now your PC connected to your TV has a nice, convenient interface that you can use from a controller from your couch, because that's what they're offering. Like, they are the Microsoft of PC gaming, which sounds weird to say. Like, isn't Microsoft the Microsoft of PC gaming? Like, they have an open platform. Well, they don't. Microsoft didn't give away Windows for free, but like a Linux-based operating system designed for what it's supposed to do. They have their own store. They're the Microsoft and Apple combined of PC gaming. They're the best of both of them. Like, trying to provide a unified experience without giving problems, but also being open like the old Microsoft was, and not super duper evil like the old Microsoft was, intentionally breaking stuff. But still, like, if these games are still written to DirectX, Valve does not control DirectX, so there's still this tension. There's still this, like, other shoe waiting to drop, where Microsoft could wake up and go, why are we letting them do this? Why are they allowed to take all the profit and market share by selling a machine that doesn't run Windows, that runs Windows games? Why are we allowing that to happen? But I think Microsoft's mostly distracted by AI and business customers, so maybe it won't be a big deal.
Also, does Minecraft still not run on SteamOS? I think... I know it doesn't run like it isn't like natively in Steam, of course, because Microsoft. But right. I remember I looked into it because Adam got a Steam Deck a couple of years ago, and I looked into, like, can we put Minecraft on it? And the answer at the time was like, you can sort of try, but it's very hacky, and it would maybe only be the Java version, and like you had to leave the walled garden to do it. And I was just like, yeah, that doesn't sound worth it. We're just not.
Yeah, I think what I saw from people who had talked to Valve in this product release is that, like, there is still a way, like, there are games that are like, this is certified to run on SteamOS and blah, blah, blah. But if you have a Windows game that's not certified to run, you can still just ask it to run. Like, you can say, well, give it a try. Like, will it work well? There might be glitches that might not work right. But, like, because of the open nature of it, they're not stopping you from doing it. It's just, like, it might not work that well. And I think Minecraft probably falls into that category of, like, you know, it's not Steam certified for whatever, but you can still run it. And if it works, then it works. All right, so this next one is where things get really interested in, and there's more of an Apple angle, but there's also even more of the angle I was talking about, like, why is Microsoft letting them do this? It's called the Steam Frame, and it is a VR headset. There is a bunch more images of it at uploadvr.com. We'll put that link in the notes. Steam Frame looks like a Vision Pro, but it's all black. It runs SteamOS 3, just like the other things does. It has a 4-nanometer Snapdragon 8 Gen 3 processor. I know nothing about the Snapdragon line, but from what I've gathered, this is basically like a current or previous gen phone processor on really high-end phones. It's an ARM processor. And Valve has added a translation layer that translates x86 to ARM, just like Apple has done, and just like Microsoft has sort of done with Windows ARM. Valve says that there's a 10 to 20% performance hit for code that is being translated, but that is only code that is running on the CPU and that is not part of an API that has a native implementation. So, for example, all those DirectX calls or whatever, those get sent to native ARM implementations of everything. It's only like the game code that is just running on the CPU. That has a performance hit, but everything else goes through the native stuff. They describe the Steam Frame as having roughly Steam Deck levels of power. Like, if you were to run a game on the Steam Frame, it's which means it's 6 times less powerful than the Steam machine. But, you know, it's a headset. Like, and they don't have an M5 to stick in it. They've got this, which I'm sure the Snapdragon 8 Gen 3 is fine, but it's no M5. According to Dave 2D, we'll put a link to his review as well on YouTube, Valve has touted its control over the whole stack. They control the hardware, the OS, the drivers, when explaining why they are able to do this better than Microsoft with their ARM on Windows efforts. Like, Microsoft has been trying to do this for a while. Ship Windows for ARM and have all the x86 stuff run well, including games. And it has proven difficult. Maybe they're not putting a lot of resources into it. Maybe they don't care as much. But Apple, the gold standard for take a binary written for a different CPU and make it run amazingly on the current CPU, has done exactly that with ARM and x86. ARM, from the early days, ARM Macs were running x86 binaries faster than many x86 Macs, and now definitely faster than all of them, including games. And Apple, of course, has its own similar technology, similar to Proton, similar to Crossover, similar to all these other things, where you can run a Windows x86 game on an ARM Mac through that type of translation layer. And Valve, when talking about this, sounds like Apple. They're like, well, when we have a problem, if we see a game has a performance problem or a hitch or something, we have all the code for the OS, we have all the code for the drivers, we control all the hardware, we can fix it. We can make the game run better because we control the whole stack. In theory, that's true of Apple, but Apple doesn't care about games as much as Valve does. But still, even Apple's doing a good job with their game porting toolkit. This headset has 16 gigs of RAM. Your choice is 256 gig or 1 terabyte of storage. It also has a micro SD slot. The reason these things all have micro SD slots is Steam Deck's got a micro SD. Steam Machine has it. This thing has it. If you have all your games and you downloaded them, like huge games, you downloaded them, and you want those games to be on your headset, yes, you could download them to your headset again, but you can also just copy them to the SD card. Take the SD card out, stick it in your headset, and now the games are there without having you re-download them, because not everybody has gigabit fiber like we do, right? Because it's a PC! Of course you can copy stuff onto a removable media and move it to something else. They all have a micro SD card slot, although it's not SD Express, which is kind of a shame. There is one USB-C 2.0 part on the rear for charging and data. It has Wi-Fi 7, Bluetooth 5.3, and a dedicated Wi-Fi 6E radio just for the wireless adapter, which we'll talk more about in a little bit. It has a magnetically attaching front piece. So the Vision Pro has a magnetically attaching back piece. Like the ski goggle part, you pull the face shield off of that. It attaches with magnets. This thing is kind of, not the reverse, but slightly different. This thing, when it's, you know, if you put it on your face, you can pull the front part of it off, and what comes off is like the ski goggle part, basically like the aluminum part. So it's got the CPU, the lenses, the screens, all the compute, like all that stuff comes off. But the rest of it is like the strap that goes around your head, the equivalent of light shield, that is a separate piece. So they've broken the thing up in different pieces. Instead of having, like on the Apple thing, the ski goggle part and the little temples, sticks, whatever, that's all one piece. And then the strap comes out. And this thing, the front goggly part with the CPU comes off magnetically. And supposedly that says, well, if we come out with a better one that is higher CPU, you can just buy that and slap it on. Or if you like a different strap or whatever and different speakers, because again, the speakers are in that part, you can mix and match those things together. So interesting, different choice there. The head strap does include integrated speakers, and they fired backwards. Like they're not in the little sticks. They're like in the, basically what you would imagine would be the light shield on a Vision Pro. They're force canceling, kind of like the Sonos subwoofers that you two like, which means they have drivers opposing each other so that their vibrations cancel out. Because when they didn't do this, the vibrations would throw off the display for like tracking and stuff. And that makes me wonder if the reason Apple put the speakers in the Vision Pro in those little, I don't know what they're called, the sticks. did Apple put the speakers in there? Because if they hadn't, they would have the same problem of vibrations. Because Apple doesn't have, like, force-canceling speakers, as far as I know. They just have single ones. But they're in the sticks. If they had put them in the metal part, maybe they would have had the same problem. So, you know, two different possible approaches to the same problem, which is, hey, speakers cause vibration. Vibration is bad for the displays and for tracking and stuff. Apple just moved the speakers out of that area. Valve left them in, like, the front sort of light shield part, but made them force canceling.
It could also just be like getting them closer to the ears, the way Apple does, is of course going to be better for everything about them. But it also probably involves cost and complexity that maybe Valve's product couldn't bear that in its margins.
Yeah, and it makes it like the one piece, like the non-replaceable piece. It's more stuff that is connected together. Like Valve's whole idea is like maybe we didn't get this whole strap and speaker part right. Maybe a third party makes a better one. Maybe make a version 2. You can replace all of those things, whereas they're stuck to the Apple headset. The Steam Frame has, which is what they call this thing, has a 21.6 watt hour rechargeable battery. The battery is on the rear of the strap. Lots of other headsets have done this. Instead of being on a cord in your pocket or whatever, it's on the back, like on the back of your head. And lots of reviewers were sort of repeating the line that I'm sure Valve told them, and lots of people have said for other things, oh, it balances it because the front thing has a weight on it because that's where the headset, the goggly part is, and then the battery's in the back and it balances it. And I'm like, look, it only balances it if there is a fulcrum in this seesaw. But there's not, because the Steam Frame does not have a top strap. The Steam Frame has a single strap like a pair of ski goggles. So I'm like, putting weight on the back and on the front, I guess it makes it feel like the front isn't sliding down your face as much, but the only way for you to make that balance is to tighten that strap. So right away I said, you know what you should have done? You should have put a top strap. The Valve Index has a top strap. Like, it's not like they don't know top strap technology. So Apple is definitely out ahead on the strap technology, but I feel like this is surmountable for them, especially since that part is replaceable. But yeah, the battery is on the back of the head. And it's smaller than the Vision Pro battery. The Vision Pro battery is 35.9 watt hours compared to 21.6. Battery life for this thing is quoted as 1 to 4 hours. So like, one is worst case scenario, four is best case. So probably in the same range as the Vision Pro, maybe a little bit better, maybe a little bit worse. The weight, it's 440 grams, which is roughly half of what the Vision Pro weighs. It's not made of aluminum. Doesn't have a front screen on it. It's plastic. It's half the weight of the, and it's half the weight of the Vision Pro, and the Vision Pro weight does not include the battery.
Mm-hmm.
So like, keep this in mind. It's half the weight of the Vision Pro with the battery, which is stuck on the back of your head. For displays, this apparently is very disappointing to a lot of the PC people. We'll put a link to the Digital Foundry's review of it, and that guy's real broken up about the screens. But, you know, anyway, the screens are 2160 by 2160 per eye, but they are LCD. And LCD does not have per-pixel lighting control, and LCDs and headsets don't even have mini-LED, dynamic backlighting or whatever. It's just one single backlight for the whole thing, which means when you put this thing on and it's showing a full black screen, what you actually see is a full gray screen. Because LCDs cannot block the light from the backlight entirely. So even though it's supposed to be pitch black in there, like it is in the OLED Vision Pro, it's not. It's gray. This is very much like the Quest 3 and the other things. Why do they use LCDs instead of OLEDs? Well, one reason is cost, because those OLEDs and Apple's things are a hojillion dollars, right? And this is not going to be as expensive as a Vision Pro. But the other reason is a lot of the gaming headsets use, like, they describe this as a low persistent LCD screen. And for combating motion sickness and other, motion artifacts and stuff like that, what was discovered very early on in the VR world was the way to do that with current screen technology, this predates OLED, was to pulse the image onto the screen. So just say, boom, here's the image, and then turn it off the screens, and then wait, and then turn on, light up for the next thing, and turn off the screens, and wait. And the reason they can do that with LCDs is because LCDs can get really, really bright. So rather than them having, like, for example, a 1,000 nit screen, or no, 100 nit screen, which that's what the light output of this thing is, 100 nit screen, they said, how about instead of 100 nits that we just show each frame at 100 nits the whole time, how about we show that frame for 1/10 of the time at 1,000 nits? So 10 times the brightness for 1/10 of the time.
Does that work?
And the reason they're doing that is because the way the human visual system works is it's much better to show an image really, really bright and then show nothing for a long time, and then show the next image really, really bright and then show nothing for another time. It's just why film projectors work well for us. Because they show the frame of film, and then they show nothing, and then they show the frame of the next frame, and they show nothing. Because while they're showing nothing, the next frame of the actual film strip is traveling to get in position to be displayed. So there's nothing they can show at that point, right? And then they show that frame, and then they show nothing, right? That's what you want to do to avoid motion smearing. Now, the Vision Pro has the OLED problem of, like, what are they called? Sample and hold. It's a reason motion looks weird on OLEDs. OLEDs can turn on and off really, really fast, way faster than LCDs, way better than LCDs, with less smearing. It's like, why don't they just do this on OLEDs? The problem is OLEDs can't get 10 times as bright. You can't show an OLED 10 times as bright for 1/10 of the time because they can't get 10 times as bright. If they could, they absolutely would, but they can't currently. So they have to show the frame pretty much the whole time on an OLED, and then OLEDs instantly change to the next frame. So you see one frame in a 24 frame per second thing for 1/24 of a second, and that frame never changes for the whole 1/24 of a second. You're like, isn't that how it's supposed to work? Not in a film projector, it doesn't. In a film projector, you see that frame briefly, and then you don't see anything for a while as the next frame scrolls up into view. Same thing with a low persistence LCD. They'll show one frame very briefly, way brighter, and then show nothing for a while, and then show the next frame, and that makes for better, clearer motion and less motion sickness and less stuttery things. That's why if you watch a 24 frame per second movie on OLEDs and don't have any motion smoothing on, some people perceive a stutteriness because it is literally showing frame one for 1/24 of a second, never changes for that 1/24, and it is never black or anything. And they'll show the next one. That's why lots of TVs have black frame insertion, where they will show OLEDs will show a frame and then insert a black frame and then show another frame. Like, they're trying to make it so the frame isn't on the screen the whole 1/24 of a second. But that cuts the brightness down and sometimes looks flickery depending how you do it. So anyway, these low persistence LCDs, for all their terrible contrast and bad black levels, they use low persistence strobing. They display each frame for around 300 microseconds, which they describe as a 3.7% illumination cycle, which I think means for the length of each frame, only 3% of the time is the screen lit up, and the other 90-whatever percent of the time, the screen is off. OLEDs can't get bright enough to do it. The perceived total brightness of really bright frame for a short period for 3.7% of the time, the perceived total brightness is 100 nits, which is way less than the Vision Pro. The contrast is way less than the Vision Pro. But within a dark headset, 100 nits is sufficient to seem bright. They're using pancake lenses just like the Vision Pro instead of the Fresnel lenses. How do you pronounce that? Fresnel?
Something like that.
The lenses in the Quest that are cheaper to make, they're like, I think they're plastic. They're like, they have lots of like sort of concentric ridgy rings on them, kind of like the lenses in lighthouses. They're cool and all, but they make things a little bit fuzzier, especially around the edges. Pancake lenses are more expensive and better. That's what the Vision Pro has. That's what this has. Refresh rate is 72 to 144 hertz, although they say 144 hertz is experimental. It's got 110-degree field of view. The Vision Pro is around 100. It's got pass-through cameras, so you don't, like, bump into things, and so you can find your mouse and your keyboard, but the pass-through is monochrome.
That's wild.
Saves money. And not only does it save money, but it's also really good in low light, because if you don't have to deal with color, you can gather more light, you know, instead of trying to worry about the red, green, and blue and stuff. There is a port, a front port on the bridge of the nose, where they say, oh, well, if you wanted color pass-through, you could buy some sort of third-party camera module and shove it in there, and now you have a color pass-through. But this is not about AR. It does pass through so you don't hurt yourself and so you can see what you're doing, but there's no AR. You're not going to be floating windows in the middle of your room. It has no idea where your walls are. It doesn't care about any of that crap. This is a VR headset for playing games. It's got IR illuminators for tracking pass-through in dark environments, so you can still play like in a really dark room. It'll still know where your controllers are. It does come with controllers. We'll get to them in a little bit. Streaming. This is one of the things they emphasized about it. It does wireless streaming, as in, yes, you can play games on the headset. I just described like the ARM CPU and everything. But you can also run games on your PC, on your Mac, on your Steam machine, and stream those games to your headset. So then it's just acting like a monitor. And how does it do that? Not by connecting your headset with a wire like the Valve Index. But instead, I think the Valve Index uses wire. But instead, by using a wireless protocol with a special USB adapter they have that provides a dedicated low-latency Wi-Fi connection only for the video.
USB-A all the normal networking adapter.
Hmm?
It's a USB-A adapter, by the way.
Yeah, well.
Which is hilarious.
It's a PC. PCs don't have USB-C, like, commonly.
Yeah, every, like, PC game stuff is all, like, USB 3 over USB-A.
Yeah.
Gracious.
Yeah, and they've done this because they need the lowest latency connection possible. Like, the Quest 3 can also do this. Quest 3, you can stream from PCs and stuff, but it's not great because it's sharing that connection. It's not like, again, them controlling the whole stack. Like, this is a dedicated, separate Wi-Fi connection only for visuals. If your game does network stuff, that doesn't go over this connector. The network stuff goes over the regular Wi-Fi that you're connected with, but this is just for the visual stuff. And it also does foveated streaming, which means when it's streaming stuff from your Mac, from your PC, from your Steam machine, it knows where you're looking in the thing that it's going to be streaming, and it streams at higher resolution where you're going to be looking. Just like foveated rendering works inside the Vision Pro, this is foveated streaming. And unlike foveated rendering, the thing being streamed has no idea that this is happening to it. This is purely done at the level of transporting the image. They basically probably compress the image. They take the image as it arrives at them, because when you're playing on a PC, it's not foveated anything. It's just they render the whole screen, right? They take that whole screen image, but they don't send every single pixel from that image. They send more pixels where you're looking and less where you're not, which makes us streaming lower bandwidth, lower latency. And as everyone who tried this out, this is a lot of PC gamers' first experience with foveated rendering, because not a lot of people have Vision Pros or the other fancier headsets. They're like, I tried to move my eyes and catch it, and I couldn't do it. Like, Valve did a demo where they were streaming, like, Half-Life Alyx or one of those other VR games. And instead of foveated streaming, they did streaming where it literally sent blackness everywhere except for where you were looking. Like, so just a little, like, you know, 2-inch postage stamp of where you're looking. Like, if you when you looked at the mirror display, it's like you see a black screen with a little section of the where it's rendering. And when you're in the headset, you can't tell that it's doing this.
Wait, why is it
every time you try to look into
that.
The black area, you can't look at it?
Why don't the OLED models do that to save power?
I think with the blackness, I think you can tell, like, in peripheral vision that it's not the full image there. Like, I think you need to put something there, but you can't catch it. You can't ever look at the blackness. I think you can detect that it is black instead of blurry or whatever. I mean, we've all used the Vision Pro. Foveated rendering, like, we see it in the UI. It's very difficult to catch. You can catch it a little occasionally, but it's very difficult to catch. And the thing about foveated streaming, like I said, foveated rendering, like in Vision OS, the OS is doing that, like the window compositor or whatever is, you know, displaying the UI in the Vision Pro. When it renders that frame, it has to know about where your eyes are, and it renders a foveated image, which is why you get a foveated image when you're mirroring it, because that's what it's rendering. But foveated streaming, it's taking a non-foveated thing, and then, like, it's just a transport thing. So it's very clever, very interesting, saves bandwidth, makes it higher performance, and, you know, and it allows you to be better than the Quest 3, essentially. That's what everyone said. It's like, I tried the Quest 3 streaming. It wasn't that good. It's better on this thing that I tried. They say you can stream from PC, Steam Machine, or, quote, any device running Steam. That's what Digital Foundry said. And again, the Macs can run Steam, so I'm assuming that includes Macs. Media consumption is not really a thing. Valve said you can use a web browser, so don't think you're going to have cool theater. I mean, third-party opportunity. People can make cool theater apps and stuff like that, but this is not a priority for this product. This is a game thing. And to that extent, it comes with two controllers, two handheld controllers with a full set of buttons and triggers for 2D games, which is not true of all the Quests and other things like that. A lot of times they have controls for VR games, but they don't have sufficient controls to play, like, just a regular PlayStation game, or I know it's going to be a PlayStation game, but, like, a regular game console, like an Xbox game, expects you to have a certain number of triggers and buttons these days or whatever. And a lot of times VR controllers don't have them, but the Steam Frame does. Their controllers, it's basically like a regular console controller split in half. And there, it tracks where your hands are, and there's little LEDs that shine through the plastic. You know, they're VR controllers. The price of all of this, the headset, the controllers, supposed to be less than $1,000. No prices are announced, so people are just, like, trying to feel out, like, how expensive is it going to be or whatever. The point is, it's not Vision Pro prices. Less than $1,000. More than the Quest, sure, because it's better hardware than the Quest, but less than $1,000. And Valve would not be quiet about, people would say, this thing ships with ARM. You're playing Windows games for a different operating system on a different architecture. Are you going to do more of that? And they're like, we can't wait to make more ARM hardware. They're like, we're not announcing anything yet, Steam Deck 2, but we can't wait to make more ARM hardware so we can run x86 Windows games on non-Windows, on non-x86. Which, again, boggles my mind that Microsoft is lying. Microsoft is trying to put Windows on ARM, but game makers are out there. Time for me to make my PC game. Better compile it for x86 so 50% of my users can eventually run it on ARM on Linux. So weird. Now, having a Vision Pro, having Casey's Vision Pro now, none of the specs of this headset may be jealous or interesting. I'm like, man, the Vision Pro hardware is amazing. But it did make me think, you know, Apple, your $3,500 headset would be an amazing streaming VR headset if you could connect it to Steam. And if Apple knew or cared anything about gaming, they would have long since made a deal that said, hey, if you get Steam on your Mac or your PC, you can stream VR games to it using the Vision Pro. Can you imagine how amazing that would be? These screens look so good. Now, maybe the persistence isn't as good as the low persistence LCD or whatever, but and maybe the field of view is a little bit lower. But and I wish, now, Apple, to its credit, just did come out with the ability to buy the PlayStation VR controllers for Vision Pro, but then what do you get to play on them? Do you get to play all PC games that are available on Steam? No, you do not. Do you get to play the VR games available on Steam? No, you do not. You get to play the games that are available on Apple's App Store, which is a much more limited selection. And by the way, the PlayStation controllers probably don't have all the buttons needed to play PC caliber games. Now, these three products, Steam Controller, Steam Machine, Steam Frame, and their existing handheld Steam Deck, they have essentially a complete suite of console level hardware. They are basically Sony, which has the PSVR and PlayStation 5, Microsoft, which has quote-unquote PC gaming, and Nintendo, which has the Switch, combined into a single company on an open platform running Linux with the most popular non-console gaming platform. Steam might actually be bigger than all the consoles, I'm not sure. Playing games for an operating system that they don't control on an architecture that's different than the one that people are targeting. And I think they're going to be successful. It boggles my mind, but I think they hit it out of the park with these products. Again, no prices have been announced. These are coming in 2026, I think. But the rumor prices sound right, and they all look really good. And I'm mightily impressed with what Valve has done here.
Yeah, it looks very promising. Like, you know, I mentioned earlier, like the little square gaming PC thing looks great. And the headset. I mean, look, what we see in the headset market, we see like Apple's take on it, which is, you know, in space. And then you have like everyone else here on Earth. They're using, you know, you have like the Meta Quest series. This is obviously meant to directly compete with the Quest. And it seems like it is built like
but be slightly better and slightly more expensive.
Right, which is great because like the Quest is a very successful product line, and it is honestly a good product line. Like for VR gaming, the Quest is great. It is a
but it doesn't
great
run
product.
PC games and it doesn't run Steam games. It runs like Meta has an app store where they have their games, and yeah, I'm sure there's more games than on Apple's platforms, but like Steam is Steam. That's where all quote-unquote the game, when Declan is going to be interested in playing games, it's going to be a quote-unquote PC game that's available on Steam. It's not going to be something from the Meta App Store.
Exactly. And so, like, I think this is great. And it, you know, the things about, like, using an LCD for the display. Honestly, with today's technology, I think for most use cases, that might be the right move. Because look at what it has enabled them to do. The entire device is way smaller. It's way lighter. It's going to be way cheaper than something like the Vision Pro. It's using OLED. I don't know off the top of my head.
The size and weight aren't the thing. It's the price. Though OLEDs and the Vision Pro cost more than all four of these products combined, I think.
Yeah, almost certainly. But also, like, you know, OLED also has trade-offs. The Vision Pro is great for color and contrast. It's not so great for fast motion. LCDs are fast.
That's the thing about OLEDs. It's like I said, OLEDs are better for motion. That's why people who buy gaming monitors are getting OLEDs, because if you try to run an LCD gaming monitor at like 120 hertz or 240 hertz, which is what high-end PC gamers want to do, it becomes a smeary mess because LCDs cannot change from one color to another fast enough to keep up with 240 hertz. OLEDs can. But LCDs can get way brighter. And inside a headset, doing that thing where you show something 10 times as bright for 1/10 of the time, that's what you need for motion in a headset. So while every gamer in the world, including me probably for my PlayStation 6, is getting OLED monitors because OLED pixels change instantly from one color to another. They're perfect for this. They just can't get bright enough to do the low persistence pulsing thing that you need to do inside a headset. So yeah, LCD was the only choice. Like, people are disappointed because like, I would wish it had an OLED. Well, if you wish it had an OLED controller, it would be $2,000. Is that what you want? Because there's no, like, the current hardware reality is if you want Vision Pro style OLED things, it's going to be, you know, hugely more expensive, and you're going to have the possibility of the sample and hold blur that you get inside the Vision Pro, because they're not pulsing the thing for 300 microseconds. They think they're showing it for the whole frame.
Yeah, I think this looks like they have made a very different set of trade-offs than Apple and a slightly different set of trade-offs than Meta, but I think it's going to be, you know, for its market, which is gaming, the only competition for gaming is the Quest. That's it. Like, there's no other competition out there
in this
market.
And Valve's previous products. Like, that's the thing. This is not Valve's first headset. This is not Valve's first... There's a Verge article about, like, the earlier Steam machines. They made various kind of Linux PC looking things or whatever, but they learned from those. They learned, why weren't those successful? Why didn't those take off? What is bad about our current headset? How can we make it cheaper and better for games? Like, they've really nailed, like, kind of like game consoles do, where it's like, we know what people are going to do with this. They're going to play games. How cheap can we make it and still make it good for games? And that's what they've done with these products.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to be a hit.
Yeah, these look, I mean, this is not for me today, but these all look really, really impressive.
And also, I think it's worth, you know, putting in context what it means to be a hit. It's still a VR gaming headset, and it's still VR. And what that means is gamers like it. Not all gamers, not even most gamers, but it'll do fine. It's still going to be a pretty small technical market, like in terms of like how big is it compared to computers, other, you know, gaming PCs. How big is it compared to game consoles? How big is it compared to phones? And like, it's going to be tiny compared to all those, just like, you know, all everything in VR to date has been. But I think it will do well within that market.
Yeah, and speaking of those markets, so you look over there at the Steam machine, and you really just have to think, a lot of game consoles sell. People buy a lot of PlayStations, millions of PlayStations, millions of Nintendo Switches, which I know is kind of more of a Steam Deck competitor, but Steam Deck was kind of there first, although it doesn't convert to a TV Deck or thing. A lot of people kind of wanted that, like, why don't you just make the Steam Deck like the Switch? And instead they said, how about we make one 6 times more powerful that connects to your TV? What does the console market look like with the PlayStation 6, probably still the Nintendo Switch 2, and the Steam Machine with the Xbox essentially either bowing out entirely and then retiring the brand, or them simply selling something as an Xbox that is just a gaming PC? I think Steam got there first. Like, we're going to sell you a gaming PC. We're going to give it a different name, Steam Machine. And for anybody who wants to play PC games but does not want to deal with a PC, who would previously have bought an Xbox, even though Xbox doesn't run PC games, or runs Xbox games, but they're really similar, how about we just cut out all of those nuances and say, this just runs games from Steam, the world's most popular PC gaming store, and you buy it and you plug it in and it works. And I really do think, if depending on how much marketing Valve puts behind this, they could become the replacement for Xbox as the third player in the console market, with PlayStation, Nintendo, and no longer Xbox, PlayStation, Nintendo, and Steam Machine. I think they could do that. Will they do that? Do they have an interest to do that? Or they just want to sell like these small form factor PCs to PC enthusiasts? We'll see. But like, to your point about the VR market's small, the gaming PC market is small, the console market is less small. Still smaller than mobile games, but less small. And so if Valve really wants to make money, they would do this. Now, the problem with Valve is, kind of like Apple, they're like, okay, we make all this stuff, and it's great, and we're really good at it, but the real money's in the store. That's just FYI. The reason we have so much money to make this hardware is we get a cut of all those things sold on Steam, and that makes us a lot of money, and the margins on that service revenue, they're way better than on these Steam machines and the headsets. We don't have to build any hardware, we don't have to ship any boxes, we don't have to do any warranty repairs, we just run a bunch of servers and we collect the money, and that's been going on for a long time. So maybe they're not incentivized to become the world-conquering third console maker with the Steam Machine, but it has the potential to be that, because I think they've already made a better non-Nintendo, non-Sony console than the Xbox, because unlike the Xbox, this runs quote-unquote PC games. So it opts out of that whole, like, getting exclusive games and doing all this stuff. It's like the whole world of PC games is for you. So it's like console versus PC, or console versus console that's a PC. I also think it's amazing.
And I love the idea of, like, you know, the Steam Deck has been great for this so far, of like creating a market for Windows games to run on a platform that's not Windows. And, you know, as the Steam platform, Steam OS platform, as it gets more users, it gets more power in the market. It starts to become such that game makers will actually make sure their games work on it. Like, you know, they'll test on it. And then, it, you know, if there's enough demand there, if it's a big enough user base there, then not only will game compatibility be better overall, like it'll be more ubiquitous and kind of, and, you know, just better quality, but also it'll make it impossible for Microsoft to ever shut it down. And as somebody who uses Windows only for gaming, like, I don't use a Windows PC for any other reason, and dealing with anything about the PC that's not the game is a huge pain in the butt that just gets in the way. I love the idea of a console-style experience, but having the high-quality Windows games. That's great. And the bigger and more powerful and more popular that platform gets, the harder it will be for it to go away or to get shut out. And that's only good for gamers, because it gives you more choices. It makes more people, you know, port their games to it with higher quality. As I was saying, like, it's just better for everyone. And Valve can take their 30%, whatever. It's fine, you know.
I think it's less than that. But yeah, there is the danger of them becoming the Apple, like in the bad way, the Apple of the PC market. I mean, so it's important to distinguish between Steam, the store, which is already massively dominant and has been, and these products, which remains to be seen how dominant. Well, the Steam Deck is doing pretty well, but there are other handheld gaming PCs from other companies, right? That's the beauty of the PC market. Like, people, other people can make hardware. Like, it's the whole idea, right? It's a competitive market. You can't just, unlike the Switch, where that's the only place we'll run Nintendo games, you can buy a handheld gaming PC from Asus or whatever, and it'll run the same games. But Steam, the store, has been so dominant for years that when these days, when anybody talks about, like, how is this game doing? How is this PC game doing? Like, I just did a podcast where I was talking about Arc Raiders and Marathon and stuff, and they're like, oh, you know, all these stories in the PC gaming press. Arc Raiders is doing great, and Marathon is doing poorly, and Destiny has few users. You know, checking these live service games to see how they're doing, like, basically the ratings. Like, how are the games doing? All they talk about, the foundation of all that information, are numbers from Steam. A, because Steam publishes those numbers, and B, because they use that as a proxy for the entire PC industry. And it's not the whole PC industry. You can download games directly from a game maker and install them with their own janky-ass installer that you hate. Like, that still exists, because, again, it's the PC world. It's not like Apple, where there's no quote-unquote side-loading. Like, you can do anything you want. But Steam has just used this, like, we just looked at the Steam charts, because Steam shows them, and because, yes, Steam's not all of the market, but it's enough of the market that it is the stand-in for the entire market. So and every YouTube channel, they're showing charts from Steam to show how well a game is going. You'd be like, but that's not all the users. And it's like, it's enough of them. It's enough that it's representative. So this Steam is the entire PC gaming market as far as we're concerned when we're seeing how well a game is doing, which is fascinating.
All right, is that it?
Yep.
And unless we can get free hardware from Valve. Apparently we didn't get this. All the YouTubers that I watch got to play with this hardware a week ago. But yeah, I think we're too far afield to, on this Apple Focus podcast to get any of this stuff.
As they know, we are the leading PC gaming podcast.
Right, exactly. Where one host is constantly berated to build a gaming PC and refuses to do so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what they want, right?
The other host has like 9 gaming PCs and 6 of them are broken and they all just
and some of them have puffy batteries. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. All right, thanks to our sponsors this week, Factor, Grammarly, and NordLayer. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of membership is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. Every single episode has bonus content that only members can hear. This week's Overtime is about Affinity's graphics apps are now going free, and people got upset about that. We're going to talk about that in Overtime. Join now to listen to atp.fm/join. Thank you so much, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.
Marco, you noted in our internal show notes that you made a trip to Home Depot, which means I assume you actually made 7 trips to Home Depot.
That's the way.
Amazon helped a little bit reduce that. So I thought you would enjoy this brief story of me learning to do a very basic thing that I should have known a long time ago, but did not. It's a common theme in our after shows or pre-shows. So I'm trying to like hang some shelves in my garage, and I got the shelves like a year ago, and the problem is there's not that many studs in certain spans that the shelves need to go, and I have learned a long time ago, do not use drywall anchors for anything ever.
Especially not for shelves.
Yeah, they will always fail you. And so I've been delaying installing these shelves. I installed one set where like one of the two, like I guess arms of the shelf was in a stud and the other one had to be anchors. And of course, like the anchor got all loose and the shelf bent. And yeah, it was like, okay, that's not going to work. So I had an idea. I'm like, all right, I'm going to install a bunch of horizontally installed 1x4 boards.
There you go.
Across the wall.
You were deriving from first principles, knowledge that is relevant to the industry that you're not familiar with.
Exactly. So, but I'm like, all right, I've been having this in my head for months. I'm going to do this, but I'm like, well, how am I going to, like, at some point I'll like ask a friend who has a pickup truck or something if I can, you know, if they can give me a ride to Home Depot or something, or like maybe they'll deliver. And like, I just hadn't worked out in my head, like, how am I going to get wood to my house?
A pickup truck's bed is probably smaller than the inside of your SUV, just FYI, because pickup truck beds are now vestigial and don't actually carry anything.
So, but I assume, like, there's no, like, you know, my car is not as big as a full-size SUV anymore or something like that. I don't know. So anyway, eventually, I'm just gonna do it. I have some time this week. I'm just finally going to do it. How am I going to get the wood here? Do they deliver? Like, first of all, does my local hardware store even sell lumber? No, they don't. So I have to go to Home Depot, like, you know, two towns over. And I'm going to ask ChatGPT. So first, I'm like, all right, ChatGPT. I'm like, what? First of all, what are common lengths of 1x4 boards that are sold in hardware stores? And also, here's what I'm trying to do. Should I even be using 1x4s? Do I need to use 2x4s instead? And of course, ChatGPT is amazing for questions. Like it is, it was so good. It was
especially
like,
right, when you don't know whether it's right or not.
Yeah, it's like, here is a full report of, okay, here's why you might want to use 1x4s versus 2x4s, and, you know, for, and I described what I was doing, why I was putting wood on the wall, and it said, okay, you probably want to use 2x4s for that. They're like 3 times stronger in this way, and all the, you know, these other things. I'm like, all right. And then I'm like, what kind? It's like, okay, well, you're going to want this kind of wood, you know, not pressure treated, because it's, unless it's going to be sitting in water, you know, like all these different things. And it told me that they come in 8-foot segments. I'm like, oh, okay. I went out, I like put the seats out of my car with a tape measure, and I measure like, what's the longest thing I can fit in my car? And it ends up, I can fit something about 9 feet long in my car. I'm like, okay. So I went to Home Depot, and I'm like, I almost felt like a kid in a cartoon walking into an adult space and trying to fit in and trying to play it cool and not be noticed. I've never bought wood in my life. I have no idea how to buy wood. All I know is that I've seen people do it at Home Depot, and there seems to be like that entire like left side of the store against the wall seems to be all big stacks of wood. But ChatGPT helped me out. It's like, you're going to want this kind of wood, this kind of board. It comes in 8-foot segments. It should probably cost around this at a standard hardware store like a Home Depot. It even told me what kind of screws to buy, because of course I definitely would not have thought to buy screws. There is no chance I would have come back from that trip with wood and screws. I definitely would have forgotten those.
Nice.
So it told me what kind of screws to buy. It even recommended that I get like a star drive head for this purpose. I'm like, okay, great. I already have one of those fart drills that like hammers it while it screws it in. Like I got it in like,
yeah,
a multi-pack.
That's what they're called, fart drills.
Yep, yeah. I never actually had used it before today, but a year ago I had to buy a drill, and there was like a 2-pack that had the regular kind and the fart kind for like $10 more. I'm like, all right, yeah, sure, I'll use it sometime. Anyway, so all this is to say, I, in the most nerdy way possible, did research to figure out how to buy wood, and then I went and just bought it, and it was fine. I got one of those U-boat things at Home Depot, put on 15 2x4s and a box of screws, walked over, checked out, it was fine. They all fit in my car just fine. Everything worked out great, and I spent today starting the installation process for some of them, and it was all fine. I have a saw that I've used like 3 times. The kind that like you lift it up and down and it makes chops. And I don't know if it's a chop saw or not, but I don't know.
Miter saw?
Maybe the kind that you can turn to different angles.
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay,
you use it to cut miters.
Oh well, I also used it to cut wood. So
that's a kind of a cutting wood.
Oh well, I made only the most boring straight cuts. But yeah, it's been fine. I used the fart drill for some especially difficult screws for some of the shelf brackets, and it's been great.
You know, I got to say that we were talking before we started recording about you doing some wiring in the restaurant and you doing these shelves, and I feel like Marco, 5 or 10 years ago, would have been like, oh, I'll call somebody, and this will just be done. I will trade.
Oh, but the Marco of today has called a lot of people, and he's learned what that's like.
Well, yeah, that's
one thing Marco is very experienced with, and I think he now fully understands what are the downsides of having someone else do something for you.
Yeah. Also, like this is a really small job for like if you're going to call someone, like putting some 2x4s on your garage wall and hanging some shelves on them. That's like is that even worth anybody's time? And whatever it would cost, I would be like, I probably should have just done this myself.
I mean, you're not wrong. I'm impressed. Good.
Plus, I feel very accomplished. I'm like,
right?
I bought wood and I cut some of it and I put it on the wall.
There you go. And it probably won't spill everything that's on the shelves onto the floor.
Most likely.
Unlike the one that was in the drywall anchors.
Yes, that was unpleasant. But that's, I still have more to do, but like I've done the hardest ones that were above the garage door where there's not that many studs. I probably used way too many screws, but I don't care.
Better than too few.
Right, exactly.
Until you have to unscrew it someday, and you're like, who put all these screws in here?
Also fair. All right, titles. I think it's got to be My Basement is Beautiful, right?
Oh, it has to be.
Okay. It is, though. That's my, you know, I don't have a lot of smart things, but I've got that, the, you know, humidity, temperature, VOCs, particulate, like, the basement is monitored better than the rest of the house. I should actually buy some of those for the rest of the house, too. But...
Probably.
Yeah. I mean, the rest of the house doesn't really have any, like, moisture and problems like that, but basements do. But, yeah, no, that basement's great.
I'm still giggling about how much I offended
you.
Get
off the floor of that basement.
Jesus.
It was fantastic.
All right. Goodbye, live people. We're going to do overtime. Thank you for hanging out and being live people.